It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We've got a great global panel for you. Louise Matsakis from Los Angeles, from Finland, Patrick Beja from the UK, Nate Langson. Lots to talk about. A new presidential administration. Is that going to be good or bad for big tech? Hard to tell. We'll talk about Alphabet and the end of the loon balloon, Apple's stock on an all-time high, and what's the story with Clubhouse? Is it really worth $1 billion? All coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 807, recorded Sunday, January 24th, 2021. The shuffle button for food. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Amazon Pharmacy. Amazon Prime members can save on prescription medication when not using insurance and get free two-day delivery. Learn more at amazon.com/twitrx. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's advanced technology centers like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million worth of equipment, including OEMs like Dell Technologies, and it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all the ATC offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by Stamps.com. Stamps.com allows businesses to do all their mailing and shipping right from their computer. No need to leave your home or office or home office. For a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment, go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter the code TWIT. And by Casper. You deserve a fresh start this year. Reset your rest with supremely comfortable mattresses, bedding, and more from Casper. Go to casper.com/twit1 and use the code TWIT1 for $100 off select mattresses. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. This is going to be the international edition of Twit, the show where we talk about the week's tech news. Louise is just up the road a piece. Louise Matsakis is with us, but she is a senior editor at a brand new publication called Rest of World at restofworld.org. Hi, Louise.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yes, I am in LA, which is nice. I'm not too far from you for once.
Yeah, you're down the road, I guess, not up the road, although it depends if the world's on, it depends how it's oriented.
Exactly,
anyway,
exactly.
Yeah, you're south of us. That's better. Anyway, great to see you. Congratulations on the new. This is
a nonprofit
publication aimed at covering what's going on in tech everywhere outside of the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we don't really cover Western Europe either. It's kind of the only other exception. No offense to my fellow Europeans here.
But Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Africa. I would say east of the Balkans, too, is fair game. We cover Russia.
Okay.
Just no EU and no U.S., basically. And no Australia, either. Sorry, no offense to the audience.
So how did that – I mean, did you draw lines? I mean
Well, it's sort of also – sometimes Australia is broken out, but it's also sort of just based about where we saw there wasn't a lot of coverage. There's some coverage in China, I would say. There's some pretty good coverage in India, but there's a lot of places that are just not covered at all, especially when it comes to tech. So that was sort of our mission.
I love it.
Where can we really fill a need?
And I was scanning through it, and there's articles I can't wait to read. I think this is really great.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. Yeah. It's something really different. I think there's probably enough publications covering, you know, Google in San Francisco.
Yeah. And it's actually been a problem with this show. And people often call me on it. They say, you're so U.S. centric, you know. So today we're not. Nate Langson is also here. He is a tech editor, actually in charge of Europe tech editor at Bloomberg, consumer tech reporter. Hey, Nate.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm very pleased to be here.
I'm going in reverse order of the people staying up the latest. So Louise is in our time zone. You're in the UK. So you are, what, 8 hours, 9 hours later?
I'm eight hours ahead of you. So okay. It's just gone 10:30 p.m. here.
But guess who is in tomorrow land? Patrick Beja, not Patrick. He is in France, not Patrick.com. It's great to see you again, Patrick.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm actually in Finland.
You're back in Finland. Okay.
The forest. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Good. So I'm. It's already tomorrow, indeed. And it's basically every time I come on the show, I go to bed at an insane hour.
Well, we are grateful.
We talked with Jason, who's producing now, and we decided to do it now because in a couple of months I'm going to have another baby, so no more This Week in Tech for me.
Congrats!
Yay! Congratulations!
I don't know if it's congratulations or are you insane?
How many kids do you have?
Only one for now. Oh, only the one.
You got room for more. That's okay.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, let's go with that.
I thought you were talking about your new podcast with Tom Merritt, Work Insanity. I thought that was your new baby, but you mean an actual human child. That's that is quite a commitment. Well done.
Yes, though, you know, podcasts, I have so many. It's like children indeed, but I have favorites, of course. But Work Insanity is really fun.
Nice. Nate was saying his wife likes it, which is... That's great.
She does. Huge endorsement. Ringing endorsement.
So this is an interesting week because, the in Great Britain, you guys are trying to figure out where you're going to get your ham from. Here in America, we've got a new ham in the White House. So it's all very confusing. But there is some tech news, and we're going to stay with that instead of the political news this week, which is nice because, honestly, it's been pretty political for the last few months because there's been this intersection of and I think it's going to get that way again because we're in a moment of a pause. But I think the prosecution by the FTC and antitrust prosecutions of Google and Facebook are about to get back underway once, you know, the everything else settles. They're not off the hook by any means. Do you agree? This is not something that is going to be dropped. Not in the EU either, right?
I don't think so.
Certainly doesn't seem that.
Yeah. Louise,
it seems like that.
Go ahead, Patrick. Yeah. Go ahead.
It certainly seems that there is something to be discussed and fixed and legislated and a few things, actually. The difference is now we're probably going to be able to understand what is being said and why these things are being said most of the time. But I don't think the discussion is going to end because of the change of the administration.
Yeah.
There are new problems that have arisen in the past decade, I would say, and those need new societal consensus and discussion and probably some form of legislation. And that, I don't think that's a bad thing. We need to understand the issues and get on the same page on how to deal with them. And there are many of them. So
Europeans seem more willing, perhaps, to regulate big tech. Here in the U.S., because they're American companies, for one thing, there's a bit of division of opinion on this. Louise, where do you come down on this?
Yeah, I think the question is, are we going to see meaningful discussion of this? Like, I think there's a lot of news stories and there's going to continue to be clashes between governments and big tech, but I don't know if any of the big questions that definitely do exist are actually going to get addressed very soon. I do think that these antitrust cases are going to proceed. You're seeing a very similar theme in China where they're going after their tech giants and wondering if there are, you know, market questions there. And then there are a lot of speech questions and there are privacy questions. And I think that neither of those have really been approached in very thoughtful ways. The EU tried, I think, with GDPR, but there's still lingering questions there. You know, the US needs a privacy law. Is any of this going to happen soon? I don't know. This week, I felt a lot, the last couple of weeks, I felt a lot of PTSD from 2017 in Charlottesville. It seems like, you know, we really didn't learn a lot of lessons from that. And you saw the same sort of like, you know, a hammer coming down on some of these longtime bad actors, but suddenly the platforms decided they were too bad. So the question is, are we going to be proactive now, or is it going to be another thing where something really horrific happens and then we sort of decide retroactively, okay, that was a line? You know, I don't know. I see these things sort of repeating a lot, and it's very cyclical at the moment. I hope there's actually some progress.
Yeah, it seems like U.S. politics is very cyclical, so maybe that's what it's reflecting. Willow Ramis, writing at 1-0 on Medium, says, how could Biden reshape the internet or not? There are two schools of thought. One recalls the Obama administration's cozy relationship with Silicon Valley, notes Kamala Harris's ties to companies like Uber, points out Biden's reliance on tech allies as advisors. And so that contingent says, it's going to be easy for big tech over the next 4 years. But and by the way, big tech's lobbying has been pretty aggressive, and I think we'll get even more aggressive in 2021. But there has been a lot of momentum, as he points out, for regulating big tech. Biden himself was, you know, expressed skepticism on Section 230. And, you know, there's a lot that Biden could do. In this view, Oramus writes, the Biden administration is poised to enact sweeping reforms on multiple fronts. A federal online privacy act. Of course, he's replaced Ajit Pai temporarily, at least with Jessica Rosenworcel, who is a very good FCC commissioner who is very much pro net neutrality. But gig economy workers, you know, Prop 22 passed in California, Uber and Lyft's expensive campaigns. A rework of Section 230 could be in the works, antitrust legislation. So it's kind of unknown where we're going.
Really, the issue is that we don't really know what to do. We know there are issues in, you know, things like free speech, in the gig economy, in the monopolies of these companies. But free speech, you don't know where to put the line and how to enforce it. The gig economy, we know, you know, it's fairly clear that they're not employees and they're not completely independent either, but we don't know what to put in a right. third type of status. And same with the monopolies. We, as you say on this show very often, we don't know what to do. Like, breaking them up is not going to fix the issues that we have. So I think that there's a lot of people that need to start thinking about, before saying we need to regulate, almost on a philosophical level, how do we fix the issues that were introduced by these society-altering models that were created in the past 20 years thanks to the internet, the disintermediation, the fact that everyone has a voice, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is no one knows what to do, and that's not a bad thing. Like, it's obvious that when things change that much, the old models and the old ways of seeing things don't work anymore. So we need to, you know, think about it and hopefully find solutions. But it's I don't see it as a, you know, the everything is lost that we don't know what to do right now.
No, so. It's clear we don't. On the other hand, the EU seems to, Nate. There is pretty aggressive actions already in the EU against Google and perhaps Facebook.
I mean, Google, Facebook, Amazon is a big one. Amazon Microsoft too. has been a target in the past, certainly. With the Brexit situation that we have gone through, there is an additional question that is over certainly everyone's heads in my country, which is, what does this mean for the UK specifically? You know, because we aren't necessarily going to have exactly the same relationship with you guys and with US tech companies as the rest of Europe will do, and that we would have done had we not have divorced ourselves from that. And excuse my dog, who that's probably okay. Just going out for his nightly activity. So that's one of the things that I'm particularly keen to see how it plays out. But we're not going to know that for quite some time. As far as President Biden goes, I think what's interesting from our perspective is we hear a lot through the news over the last week about, you know, the Paris Climate Accord and carbon goals and things like that. And a lot of the conversation that happens on a tech level or from a kind of big tech level is all very domestically focused, as it should be for any incoming president and administration. I think what's going to be very interesting is seeing what happens in that next step. Like, what is that? What is the international message that the Biden administration wants to communicate with Britain, with Europe, with the rest of the world, of course, as we, as I'm sure Louise will have a view on. And that those are two massive unknowns, hugely influential, massive potential impact for good or for bad. But I feel in my waters to be optimistic.
There is an argument that the Democratic Party has moved farther to the left, that there is bipartisan agreement that we've got to do something about big tech for completely different reasons, by the way. But that doesn't mean that something won't be done. Besides Rosenworcel, who is, again, temporary chair of the FCC or acting chair, Biden appointed Rebecca Kelly Slaughter as acting chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission. She is apparently very aggressive. She's been on the commission since 2018 as a Democratic commissioner, but she is going to inherit the Facebook prosecution and is apparently very concerned about privacy and big tech. So there may be at the FTC, and she, in fact, was very critical of the FTC's kind of dropping their Google investigation last year. There may be actually much more active, much more energy at both the FCC and the FTC to rein in these big tech companies. So there's debate about which way it's going to go, but it's certainly something we're going to end up watching. And I think it's something we're going to hear a lot about in 2021. Another pick from Biden, the chairman of the SEC, the Security and Exchange Commission. A lot of people are excited about Gary Gensler because he is a blockchain wonk. He actually teaches. He's an advisor to MIT Media Lab's Digital Currency Initiative and teaches courses at MIT about blockchain. So it'll be interesting to have somebody at the SEC who knows what Ether and XRP and stablecoin are.
Here's the question then that I would have on that front is the focus there blockchain as a ledger tool or specifically the cryptocurrency?
Is his more so about like investing, right? Like, I think he probably knows a lot. If he's going to be at the SEC, it's probably going to be a lot about like, should we be regulating how people trade these things? And I think there's also a lot of concern about things like Robinhood and sort of like these other investment apps. So like, even if it's not exactly just the blockchain tech, he probably understands very intimately how these things sort of work as a market. I wonder if that's part of the consideration there. I think it's cool that he has that. I just, I hope he's not like, let's use this for everything in the government.
No, I think it's the other way around. In fact, I think there might be some concern that he sees them as securities and wants to regulate them. So that will be... Well, again, this is early days. We're learning a lot about what's going on. It's in a way, it's kind of nice to see people in these positions who at least
know what they're talking about,
have some track record. Whether we agree with them or not, that'll be another matter entirely. Google also facing headwinds in the EU. In fact, it'll be interesting to see what Google. Not in the EU, in Australia. Be interesting to see what Google does. As you know, there is a bill in front of the Australian legislature to force Google to pay digital platforms, to pay news media for including their articles or even snippets of their articles in its search. In response, on Friday, Google's Australian managing director, Mel Silva, testified in front of a Senate committee that this proposed code was not only untenable, but she said, if it goes through, it would give us no real choice but to stop making Google search available in Australia. That's the nuclear option.
Nice search engine you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. You know, it's really funny because you kind of mentioned it. At the same time, I think the same day in France, we've had a law that was forcing Google to give money to the press, essentially.
That's right.
Publications, online publications for the news service that they have, for
Google News. Yeah.
And And of course, Google has been saying, listen, we can't pay you for sending traffic to you. And on the same day as, or the next day after the Australian thing, Google announced that they had come to an agreement to send money to the French press. And that was a little bit of a surprise because they had always, of course, stated that they couldn't do that and that they wouldn't. And we've had, you know, spats in Spain and Germany when Google, where Google actually shut off the Google News service. Of course, they didn't shut off the entire search engine. But the thing that's really interesting and that I'm not sure many people have looked deep enough into to understand is that we don't know to what extent this is the case, but they have included in that flow of money to the publications, they have included traffic. We don't know how it's calculated exactly, but traffic is considered has a dollar or euro amount. So it's kind of going back. It might, there might be more actual cash in that deal that they're going to funnel through to the publications, but traffic is also taken into account, which is interesting because, of course, the big argument has been, we shouldn't be paying you. We're sending you traffic and you're making money on that. But they do have a deal, apparently, with the biggest major publications in the country now.
They didn't say how much they were going to pay. It is it's a precedent, and I'm not sure it's a good precedent from Google's point of view.
I mean, Australia seems to be asking for an awful lot more, I think, yeah, than what we've seen countries asking for in the past. I mean, I read one story that suggested that something like 10% of the local, like the regional revenue, so the, you know, the money that that Google's making in Australia essentially should be passed directly to news organizations, right, which is, you know, something about $300 million or something. That's huge. And I think that's probably the main reason why Google wants to make such a big stink about this, because, like, as you say, like there is potential for other governments, other regulating bodies to look at this and think, well, Google caved,
right,
or Google didn't, and we've not seen it at this scale before.
There's also, from Google's point of view, there's a principle, which is that the Australians say, not only are we not going to look at the traffic that Google drives to the publishers, you're not even allowed to include that in the calculus for how much you're going to pay. And I think that probably pissed off Google in a way that maybe it didn't in France, where they clearly are using, considering traffic as being part of the equation.
Yeah. Conversation didn't start at that point.
No, but they got him to give in.
Adversarial, yeah. There was threatening, yeah.
And I think the threats is the biggest problem here, isn't it? I mean, this is a very bold ultimatum, and I think personally I feel it could backfire, and I think it will be frowned upon.
What if it could be even worse than that? What if they did pull search out and nobody cared, and people discovered, some people have suggested this, that's a dumb move for Google because people will discover, you know, oh, DuckDuckGo is not so bad, or Start Page is not so bad, or Ecosia is not so bad. And maybe this could start undermining Google's monopoly in the rest of the world. It could backfire.
I'm pretty sure they looked at the amount of traffic they sent, they are sending to those publications that are, fueling that lawmaking. And I'm guessing that they know the publications can't afford.
Yeah.
Have
that's what happened in Spain, down. Right?
Where are they going to be read? Like, it's where they're going to be read. People look at the news on their Facebook feed, or they, you know, they Google it, right? I mean, like, you might surface some of this. You might see sort of a weird dynamic where the rules of Bing are suddenly, like, you know, really important, and everyone is, you know, optimized for Google.
Optimized Bing.
Like, yeah, you're optimized for Bing suddenly, and maybe that's what happens. But I think that the, you know, intervening period, between Google pulling out and that adjustment would be, you know, detrimental for the Sydney Herald. Like, I'm sort of curious how the publications really feel about this and the people who work there.
Well, that's why it's the nuclear option. That's why, you know, I mean, that really is quite a threat. For Google saying, well, we could always just cut off search.
It's also like, hey, it's a small country. You know, there's not that many people in Australia. There's what, in all of Australia, there's half the amount of people there in California.
Right.
You know,
do you think Google made that calculus? Said, you know, we gotta show. I think they did that in Spain anyway. We gotta show them what it's like not to have Google.
And I don't think you'd see this threat in the U.S.
No,
is what I can say. Yeah, no. You wouldn't see this threat in a very large country. I don't think.
Yeah.
But this is becoming increasingly common. You know, you've seen a number of different platforms basically say we're just going to leave, and that seems to be an increasingly common tactic. And sometimes they take it.
Seems very childish. Seems babyish. It's like, just, you know, figure it out, work it out.
But this it reminds me of what Epic has been doing.
Yeah, with babyish. Apple. Yeah,
and that I don't feel that that's playing out particularly well for them because.
No.
Well, I mean,
it's embarrassing.
All the lost court hearings. So it's not a great way of doing it. But we, on a smaller level, we've seen it done on with smaller retailers, even in Europe, as a response to Brexit. Like, there are some companies now on continental Europe who won't ship to the UK because it's dealing with tax and customs forms and complaints. It's not worth their effort. They're just saying we'll send to anywhere in the world except Britain.
Do you remember when GDPR first happened and there were a bunch of like U.S. news sites that you just couldn't view in Europe at all? They just wouldn't load. Reminds me of that, too.
Trunk, all the Trunk publications, right? They were, you couldn't read those.
Some local newspapers that just like had old websites that were like really buggy and full of tracking, too.
It was quite a few. The Chicago Tribune, the Daily News, the Dallas Morning News, Newsday. Can you see them now? Did they give up?
Good question. Let's find out.
I think so. I've never come across one that I couldn't load. But, you know, all of these things, it's kind of part of what I was talking about earlier. We're figuring out a lot of things that aren't going to work out on the first try, but ultimately might end up coming to a consensus that I don't want to say benefits everyone, but mostly works. And certainly GDPR, when it first came out, was, I think, finger pointed at and laughed at by a lot of people who are saying, oh, but you do, you know, you can't work it out and you have so many boxes you have to click. And yes, it's the case, but you're seeing other countries and locations that are starting to think, okay, maybe we do need something. Maybe we don't go as far, but we do need something. And the thing with the newspapers, they ended up finding an agreement and in France, at least, and maybe they're not going to get as much money as they would have wanted because traffic is included into that calculation. But as a newspaper, if you have one additional source of revenue that is helping you out a little bit and diversifying your income, I think that's good for everyone in society because you have newspapers that can function a little bit better. So it's messy, but we're slowly over the next, you know, 10 or 20 years going to figure things out, I think. And GDPR is not mocked as much as it was a couple of years ago, I think.
Well, what's interesting is the fines are going to go up this year. They're going to get very serious about big time fines. Now see what happens.
And, you know, I can't access Newsday.
You can't. So
that's,
no, I'm getting exactly the same.
You're not missing a thing. I just want to say, Nate.
Well, that's I mean, I know it's quite a regional tabloid, isn't it? Is it? It's
New York. Just, yeah. How about AJC.com? That's the Atlanta News.
AJC.
AJC.com. Didgeridoo in our chat room, who I'm thinking is probably in Australia.
Nope. It's not available. Yeah. I mean, we have VPNs. If you really want to read them, you can.
Yeah. You could pretend you're in the U.S.
It's probably the expats that are going to be most affected
right? That's who wants to read them, yeah.
I can still see them both, and I'm in California. And
well, of course you can.
Well,
oh, because of the California Privacy Act. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, when I came here from New York, actually, I did notice, like, more requests for my data, more requests for my cookies than I had in New York City, for sure.
Really?
But I guess it doesn't rise to the level of GDPR because I can open both of these websites.
Interesting. Let's take a little break. This is a great panel for especially for international news. Nate Langston is here. He is consumer tech and European tech for Bloomberg in the UK, host of the UK Tech Show at uktechshow.com. Nice to see you, Nate. Thanks for staying up late with us. Louise Matsakis is also here. Her new publication is Rest of World at restofworld.org. She's a senior editor there, and it's really cool. I'm so glad to have found it. Thank you for being on, even if you're not staying up late. The latest of all from Finland, our wonderful Patrick Beja, not Patrick.com. Our show today brought to you by Amazon Pharmacy. This is a new product from Amazon that's really interesting. Why not make it easy on yourself? Stay at home, stay safe. Amazon Pharmacy saves you time. They'll work with your doctor and they'll deliver medication right to your door. You can get all the meds you need without leaving the house. One less errand, more safety for you. I have to say, I've been doing this for some time. I really think this is the future. It's amazing. It saves you time. Amazon Pharmacy delivers your medication directly to your door. No more waiting in line at the pharmacy. Who wants to do that these days? It's very easy. Have your doctor's office send the prescription straight to Amazon Pharmacy. They coordinate with the doctor to make sure everything's accurate. You're getting what you need. Of course, you can use your insurance. It works with most insurance plans nationwide. And, oh, by the way, if you're an Amazon Prime member, free two-day delivery. Yeah. Prime applies to Amazon Pharmacy, too. Plus, you'll save on prescription medication when you're paying without insurance. The pricing, very clear, easy to understand. Honestly, most pharmacies, they won't tell you the price of medication until you fill your prescription. And then they say, oh, that'll be $500. But Amazon Pharmacy shows you right up front your insurance copay, the price without insurance. You can make the right decision. Your medical information, of course, is absolutely protected. They'll never share your personal health data outside of the pharmacy. And you might say, well, what about, I want to talk to a pharmacist. You can speak with a pharmacist on staff 24/7, whether you have questions or just need advice. I've been using PillPack, which is kind of the back end for this. Amazon bought them a few years ago for a long time. It's just the easiest way to do this. It's fantastic. Amazon Prime members, you can save on prescription medication if you're not using insurance, plus get free two-day delivery. Learn more. Amazon.com/TwitRx. That's Amazon.com/TwitRx. AMAZON.com/TWITRX. That's the URL. Amazon.com/TwitRx. Thank you, Amazon, for supporting This Week in Tech. And if you haven't tried this, you really should. They just launched it, a few weeks ago. I've been using PillPack for years. Immediately went and tried it. It's really a great solution. On we go with the show. We're not done with Google. Among the pardons from the president, the former president, Donald Trump, in the last few hours of his presidency, former Google engineer Anthony Lewandowski. He was working at Google's self-driving car division. He left, founded a startup, a trucking startup. I think it was called Otto, which he sold to Uber. He brought with him, however, according to Google, a bunch of, company secrets. In fact, the judge said during his sentencing, his theft of documents and emails constituted, quote, the biggest trade secret crime I have ever seen. Lewandowski was ordered to pay $179 million, including $756,000 in restitution and $95,000 fine. I'm not sure the status of that because, remember, he filed for bankruptcy immediately. The president has issued a pardon. And his sponsors in the pardon, kind of not a surprise, Trump supporters and tech billionaires Peter Thiel, one of the first investors in Facebook, and Palmer Luckey, who created Oculus Rift, among those supporting a pardon for Lewandowski. The press release says, Lewandowski paid a significant price for his actions and plans to devote his talents to advancing the public good. So he was sentenced to 18 months in prison. He won't be going. He wasn't going to go until COVID was over. He won't be going now. I think he still owes the money, however. I don't think a pardon can let you off the hook for that.
So without getting political, do you know what would motivate a pardon like this?
Oh, you're just sure. Giving me a big fat opening, aren't you? You're trying to get me in trouble, aren't you?
No, I'm genuinely curious.
Well,
unless
we can say I mean, part of it is.
I was really surprised. Peter, I was really surprised.
It is surprising because it was a fairly big story and, as the judge said, a fairly heinous theft of trade secrets. I'm sure Google isn't too happy about it. On the other hand, he wasn't in jail because of COVID-19, and it was an 18-month sentence. It wasn't the I wouldn't want to do it, but it wasn't the longest sentence in the world. I think the fact that two prominent Trump supporters were in favor of it probably had something to do with it. No innuendo here. We'd heard news stories that there was a lot of money changing hands in lobbying for pardons. No idea if this was, you know, one of those pardons.
This makes me think that is Anthony working on something that, you know, perhaps one of these investors is interested in? There has to be like a convenient reason, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like, you know, is his genius really that so important? That's sort of how the pardon was, you know, promoted, right? It was this idea that like this guy's going to use his knowledge for good and he's so smart that he should be free. And I don't really know about that. He's been shown to have terrible decision-making qualities, right? But I think that, you know, perhaps one of these people, you know, wants his talent for something. I think that self-driving cars is still an incredibly
that's true.
You know, attractive market.
That's true.
You know, this guy, that's what I'm thinking about here. And I think it also shows me that Peter Thiel is still closer to the president than I might have thought, because there's, you know, been some reporting that perhaps their relationship has soured a little bit, or at least they haven't really, you know, Peter Thiel hasn't like made a speech for Trump in a while or anything like that. So I thought it was very, very curious. To see something like this.
There were a lot of pardons, all of them curious. You know,
right, just so Steve Bannon, a lot of other sort of like famous Trump figures. But I don't think that Anthony was somebody that like you would have associated necessarily with being.
I wouldn't associate him with Lil Wayne either.
Well, Lil Wayne was like a huge Trump supporter.
Oh, that's true.
Like that makes more sense to me. I also think like there's probably been a couple of like weird Hollywood parties where they've run into each other, right? But like when was, you know, Trump hanging out with Uber engineers, right?
Yeah.
Like
the fine probably stings a little bit more than the 18 months in prison.
Yeah, so just so this is clear, he's not going to do the 18 months in prison, but that's it. That's what he got pardoned for. So it's not like, because the thing that came to mind, and it's a completely different thing, but just Chelsea Manning was pardoned by Obama, of course.
Her sentence was commuted. Yes. Yeah.
Right. So it's a very different story, but I'm just, you know, if you want to think about things that are a little bit more controversial, possibly the fact that he's not going to do 18 months in prison is not like it's not going to change the face of the earth and democracy.
Does France or Britain have anything like this where an outgoing prime minister or president can pardon, just willy-nilly pardon anybody he wants? That's a strange
queen,
thing.
The queen can do it.
The queen can. Well, the queen should be able to. That's different.
But she you know, we recycle queens far less frequently than prime ministers and presidents.
What is it usually someone for? Like someone wrongly convicted? Like, is there sort of like a theme that it usually goes to?
Is it clemency?
Clemency.
Who does the queen usually give it to? Like, is it corrupt? Is it a good thing usually? Or like, what's sort of the pattern?
That's a good question. I mean, it so rarely seems to happen, but there was one of a murderer, I think, who he'd ripped a narwhal tusk, like something off the side of a museum, when there was a terrorist had gone on a rampage on London Bridge with a knife.
I remember this.
And he'd gone and he'd tackled this guy to the ground. He pulled off this narwhal tusk and he breached, I think, the terms of either he was on day release or something.
Oh,
and
right,
apparently
right.
I think he got a royal pardon for something like that. So it is a rare, you know, it's a rare act. It's not kind of like
he sounds like a hero. This sounds like, you know, kind of burn, right? Like the queen like looks good. Like this guy saved everyone from a terrorist, but he also like sort of had a dark past. Like that seems like a nice,
so there,
that's a nice,
it's
story,
a very,
right?
It gives off a very different image to the public that can happen on a rare occasion, that somebody did something for the public good, saved lives. It's not, you know, what the Queen does much more regularly would be issue knighthoods in the new year to people who have done great things. So it's more that she will reward people for good rather than offer clemency on a routine basis to people who may or may not have been wrongly convicted or
so too harsh. Here's a Washington Post article that says just about every country has a pardon power, but actual use of it varies all over the place. The pardon power in the U.S. actually comes from the monarch's pardon power in Britain. Queen Elizabeth has used the power in the past three decades largely in posthumous cases. The one I remember is Alan Turing, who she pardoned, remember, posthumously.
Yeah, and the Prime Minister's office apologized.
And very appropriately, and that's thanks to John Graham Cumming, who is a good friend of the network and at Cloudflare, and he launched a campaign to get Turing, get an apology from the British government, which was successful, which I think is great.
Do you know what the Queen's pardon is called, though?
No.
It's not called a pardon. It's called the Royal Prerogative of Mercy.
Mercy.
Which is just such a rock and roll way of saying...
Nice Queen, one. May I have your royal prerogative of mercy, please?
Wow, mercy flows from the monarch.
Yeah.
She pardoned... Yeah. She pardoned.
I don't have a. I don't have. I'm not. I don't think we get a lot of those in France. It didn't make a big impression on me anyway. So it's not as flamboyant as, you know, the Queen or even the U.S. President. I think
the King of Thailand pardons half or a third of the prison population every year on his birthday, but that's mostly because they have no parole system and a well overcrowded prison system. So yeah, this is not actually as unusual as I thought it was, but, pre-pardons are rare. Pardoning somebody before they commit a crime. And that's something, I think was considered too.
Can I say one last thing on this?
Yes.
On the knighthood thing. So, you know, we have that too, and it's the National Medal of Freedom. And I thought it was hilarious because it usually goes to, like, you know, heroes, civil rights heroes, you know, people have done really, you know, great things as a congressman or something. But Trump has given way more of them to sports players and athletes.
Yep. Yeah. He likes athletes.
Yeah. You know, he loves doing that.
I had dreamt last week that maybe a time would come when that we wouldn't have to use the word Trump in a sentence for a while, but I guess for a few more weeks we will mention that because it is, you know, it's still going on. Google is again in point. Google's just it was a no good, very bad year for Google, and they're in trouble again. You may remember they fired or forced the exit of Timit Gebru, who is a AI researcher they had brought in to lead the AI ethics team, and that was kind of controversial. Now they're investigating her colleague, Margaret Mitchell, because Mitchell had been using an automated script to go through her messages to find examples showing discriminatory treatment of Gebru. Google locked her account, saying, well, they didn't fire her, but they locked her account, saying they're investigating why she downloaded a large number of files and shared them with people outside the company. Yeah, I understand that's probably an automatic process at a company like Google. Nevertheless, maybe they should start thinking a little bit about the optics of all this.
I think it really shows how hostile the relationship has become between Google and a small fraction of its workforce, right? I think that that's really what's going on here. Like, this employee clearly feels very upset about what's happening at her workplace. And I think that, you know, in Google's defense, I think that this behavior, like, you know, without any context, is sort of the kind of thing that you would lock an employee's account for, right? Like, this is, you know, a basic sort of security measure when you see an employee downloading all sorts of stuff, especially in a large organization like Google. But, you know, they've been caught a couple of times. And so as Amazon, some of these other companies sort of taking these, you know, what are framed as apolitical actions when what's going on here is they are sort of fighting back. And the problem is that it's, you know, in the company's interest to protect whatever, you know, incriminating evidence might be within the company, right? So I don't know. I think it really just shows that the hostility is really high.
It's really not a good, this is poor, I shouldn't say poor Google, but poor, because they brought this, this is all self-inflicted. This has not been a good year for Google at all. They just struggled.
Can I just ask, on the issue here, was the issue that the woman in question was using a script or an AI to mine data for evidence, keywords, or other data sets, or was it that the data on the whole was being shared outside of the company walls.
I think probably a combination of all of those.
A little
things.
Of both, but certainly sharing it outside the company's got to be a big red flag. Yeah. You know, when you see a lot of internal information being exfiltrated from any company, I think that's going to trigger an immediate investigation and lockdown.
There's also a lot of surveillance inside the company. And I remember a few years ago, I don't know if you guys remember the Google memo, but when I was working on that story, there was a lot of sort of consideration inside the company about, like, you know, when you open a Google Doc, which is what the memo was, you can see everyone who's gone in and out of it, right? So it's really hard to get that memo because it was very clear to them that the company was just watching that document and what was happening to it.
Yeah.
So I think this is fairly, you know, known inside the company that they're watching sort of your every move, which is not uncommon.
Yeah. Speaking of Google, Alphabet is popping its balloons.
See, this so is, many puns.
This is the Google, the Alphabet that I kind of cherish and love. Kind of the wacky. Let's try it. Let's see what happened. The Project Loon, which was named partly because they were balloons, but I think also partly because it was a little loony, was one of their moonshots. The idea to put high atmosphere balloons all over the world to distribute the internet. It launched in 2013. It never really had a chance of making any money. By 2018, they'd graduated from Google's X, which is their moonshots, and it was made a division, one of Alphabet's other bets. That's actually the beginning of the end, because now we're starting to see how much this is costing. It got its own CEO, it got some outside funding. And there were some uses of it. You may remember in Peru after an earthquake, they put the balloons up there to provide internet. Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Last year, there was a pilot project in Kenya delivering bandwidth. But AstroTeller, the appropriately named head of Google X, and also the chair of the Loon board, he killed his own offspring. He recommended Alphabet no longer fund it. And no one else was interested in picking up the mantle. Astro said, you know, this was a long shot. Even when we started it, he says he gave it about a 1% or 2% chance of succeeding. And I think partly the fact that Elon Musk's satellites, Starlink satellites, are going to do the same thing better. And they're already going. And just the whole idea, I mean, they learned a lot, but it's over. For Loon,
I think they're seeing the writing on the satellite wall.
Yeah.
Between Starlink, which is starting to actually be commercially usable, even if it's in beta. There's OneWeb. It seems that these solutions are filling the need that Loon was addressing and much more. And if it works, you really don't need, because it seems like it does. Loon works. Technically it works. It's just,
yeah,
you don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Well, and also Facebook had a similar idea with drone planes called
Aquila.
Yeah. Which sounds like Aquila, but these weren't Killa drones. It's actually Latin for eagle, I think. But they killed that a couple of years ago.
I think Loon also is just like not really as innovative as it seemed to be. Like, even though the balloons were really cool,
right.
But it was expanding, you know, existing cell tower
low
coverage,
tech.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is very different from like Starlink, which is like satellites that are beaming down the coverage to areas that don't already have it. That's why Loon was so great in disasters, because it was like, okay, the fiber is down, so you're going to use these balloons instead. But, you know, it's mostly areas where there was already fiber coverage, because they were just expanding that a little bit. It wasn't this like, we're going to bring it to the masses who don't have any don't have any tower nearby. And I think that was part of it. We read a really fun story about how the balloons were going down in Uruguay, which didn't even use them at all. But they were falling into like rural Uruguay all the time.
Oh, jeez.
Sorry.
Stephen Levy, writing in Wired, talked about the fact that in the decade that Loon's been around, internet access globally went from 75% to 93%, He also says, and I don't know if this is Levy editorializing or if it's true, the remaining 7% are primarily populated by either those who can't afford the 4G phones you need for loon signals or aren't convinced that the internet was worth the effort. Like, just internet abstainers. And Teller came to realize loon was unlikely ever to contribute to Alphabet's profits. But Teller said, you know, it's not a failure. He said it was a successful experiment. Levy asked him, what's an unsuccessful experiment? And Teller said, the real failure is when the data tells you what you're doing isn't the right thing and you do it anyway. So the success of this failure was to call it quits.
Stopping.
That's the success.
That's harsh.
I actually can believe that in a way. I feel like all the best lessons I've learned as part of my career,
yeah,
I've learned as a result of screwing something up and not doing it twice. And I think failure is a fantastic teacher, certainly has been for me. So I kind of buy this. And I think the analysis is accurate that this is just maybe this was something that could have worked earlier. But it's too expensive to deploy, to maintain, you know, it doesn't impact the bottom line so much. But I do still think there's something in this idea of balloons and temporary internet access, as you said, Louise, like in disaster zones and in places with natural disasters or something else where connectivity is cut off, anything that you can rapidly deploy can be massively beneficial. I've seen, I think it's Vodafone. This must be going back 10 years, but they had a backpack, like a 3G cell tower backpack that someone would literally wear on their back and carry around to increase cell connectivity in areas hit by natural disaster. So like there's a genuine need for these sorts of rapid deploy, but rapid, retrieval things to be in existence, but just maybe not on the scale that Google thought it could do with this.
Will Rogers said it best. If you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. And so there's apparently a few dozen loon balloons still floating around. They're going to try to bring them in and lay them to rest. But that's it for Project Loon. Aw.
Such a lot of hot air.
Yeah, there are a lot of puns, aren't there?
I was waiting for that. So many.
All right, let's move on to Apple. Apple stock went through the roof on Friday. That's another adage. You buy on the rumor, you sell on the news. They're buying on the rumor because it is thought that Apple will have amazing, maybe its best first quarter ever when they announce their results this coming Wednesday. Analysts expect that Apple's quarterly revenue for the quarter ending December, which includes the new iPhones, new Macintoshes, new watches, new iPads, all new stuff, and of course new services, the Apple One plan. Analysts think that their quarterly revenue will be the highest of all time, exceeding the $100 billion mark. And so Apple stock price at its highest ever.
MagSafe.
Are you hoping? Are you talking about the MagSafe on the iPhone 12? Or are you talking about the rumor that Apple's going to put MagSafe back on its laptops?
Back on its laptops. I feel like that's the most important thing. I'm really excited as a dog owner, as like a clumsy human. I'm just kidding that was what drove the stock price. But do think that it seems like there's some good Apple news, and I'm happy to see sort of the product direction that they're moving in now.
Well, on the MacBooks, they're essentially going back. They're turning back the clock 5 years if the rumors are to be believed. They're removing the touch bar and getting MagSafe again and adding some I.O. So that's, I don't know if there's something to be concluded.
Getting rid of the MagSafe originally, was that a thinness thing, right? It was a compromise about thinness, right?
They wanted to go to Type-C, right? And so I think that there was a lot to be said for Type-C. I hope they don't take out the Type-C charging capability and have some proprietary charger again. I think that is
God, that's a good point.
That's the wrong direction. But I think you can make a breakaway Type-C charger of some kind. I know you can. Companies are doing it.
Maybe that's what it is. They just didn't have that innovation yet. Yeah. Now they've sort of been able to marry them together. But if anyone's had their MacBook Pro flying.
MagSafe? That's the question, though.
And
they add MagSafe to Type C.
I don't have a dog, Louise, and maybe I'm not as clumsy as you. I didn't like MagSafe.
It kept, really?
Yeah, it just was too easy to disconnect.
Now, you need to work in more coffee bars. That thing was just, you're sitting in a Starbucks, working on that screenplay, planning that podcast. Someone walks past you with two venti Americanos and you can kiss goodbye to that cable.
Not just the cable, the whole laptop goes with it, right? It's flying through the air.
Well, unless you have MagSafe.
Well, if you don't have MagSafe, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Not only do they plan to drop the touch bar, which, you know what, let's be honest, that's as bad as Project Loon. It's time to stop digging that hole. They finally got rid of those butterfly keyboards, which are terrible. And yeah, you're right, Patrick. They're saying maybe this is the rumor, Mark Gurman, he's usually pretty well connected. Maybe this is a trial balloon. Maybe we'll put an SD card reader back. Why? What do you think? I would love that.
It doesn't tie into their services.
Doesn't make any sense.
Thinking.
No.
You know, you look at the figures for Apple's last quarter and practically for the last 3 years, and the growth in its services divisions, and obviously with the recent or relatively recent Apple One as well. Like anything that doesn't tie into something that can either mean you need more iCloud storage or you need better abilities to share or other ways to share things with family or colleagues. Like it sort of feels at this point that if it doesn't tie into that in some way, then Apple doesn't have an interest in it. So I can't see that being brought back.
I agree. It doesn't seem like it could be possibly come back.
I suppose, is there enough complaint from their like core, user base? Because they really want to be sort of like the niche for creators. And like, is there enough sort of like they realize that enough creators are moving away or, very annoyed by that capability? That's the only reason I could see. Because like, you're not going to see like a professional photographer put everything in the cloud, right?
Right.
It's a really good point. And definitely one of the arguments back at the time that it was removed was that not every, pros don't all use SD cards. They were using compact flash and things like that. And that's not, the technology's moved on a lot since then. And now SD is just widespread. So arguably you could bring that back. But then if you're going to do that, why not do what Apple does very well and just force the industry to evolve and move everyone to micro SD? I know they're not as fast for the pros, but if you want a physical little thing to shove in the side of a laptop, then there are smaller devices out there than SD card. I've got an SD card with Wi-Fi in it somewhere. It's called an iFi, I think.
Yeah, they went out of business, by the way, Nate. Bad news.
If anyone wants to buy an iFi,
they're gone. I mean, Apple has driven the market for dongles like this. I mean, I have a numerous dongles just so I have an SD card in my cameras. All of them, and I pop it out, and I have to have some way to read it, and I don't know. I'd be happy. Maybe so. We'll make Louise happy with MagSafe, and I'll be happy with SD cards, and nobody's going to miss the touch bar. I don't think that really took off.
No,
I would love to read an article that's just an interview with people who love their touch bar. Like I would love to read that.
Oh, they're there. They're there.
So I'm sure they're out there.
I am actually, no, I don't love it. I just don't hate it. And I think that's the best you can get. It's people who don't actively hate it. I'm like, it's fine. I don't really use it.
Better Touch tool, which is a third-party thing that actually makes it usable. And it's like a little display there. So, I mean, it's okay. My big problem is I kept hitting it and things would happen. Siri would pop up or my calendar
Siri popping up all the time was so annoying.
But Better Touch tool lets you take all those away and then you can see time, day, weather, battery, things like that, which I guess that's marginally useful. I don't know.
I mean, just to be clear, it's a rumor. It's not, we're doing the eulogy.
Rumor,
it's not
rumor,
gone.
Rumor.
It might stay.
In fact, I think it's not a completely credible rumor, even though it comes from the highly credible Mark Gurman. Let's take a break. Then we'll talk about some new stuff coming along. Apple seems to be some indication Apple will do a VR headset this year. I don't know. That seems a little bit odd. Facebook has a big case going to the oversight board. We will talk about that. And I don't know, maybe do a little TikTok too. And the Bernie Mittens meme, we got to, that's the happiest story of the week. Are we sick of Bernie Mittens yet? Or is that?
No.
Can never get sick of that.
People said they were sick of it about an hour after it started, but in reality, it wasn't sick.
Who doesn't love a picture of Bernie Sanders all folded up with his big old mittens? And it just happened that the photographer took it with a nice, easy to edit white background. So highly memeable. Although I've seen a lot of photographers, including the one who took that picture, said, I never, ever want to take a meme picture. I hate it. There's my picture everywhere. Our show today brought to you by the folks at WWT, Worldwide Technology. That was my last, I have a real fondness for WWT because that was my last time on an airplane back in March. Not last forever, but for some time, I imagine. Lisa and I flew out to St. Louis to see their Advanced Technology Center. Wow. This is something they began building about 10 years ago. It started small, a couple of racks, one building. It's now in, I think, four or five buildings, mile after mile, $500 million worth of equipment. See, WWT is a trusted partner for any big business, for the technologies, for the consultants, the software design. They do so much. But one of the things they always want to know is they want to know how your stuff will integrate with the new stuff and so forth. So they built this ATC, hundreds of OEMs, $500 million of equipment, ranging from the big guys, heavyweights like Dell Technologies and VMware and Intel, to the little emerging disruptors that are changing the world like Equinix. WWT has been doing this for a long time, a trusted partner for so many enterprises. A lot of their customers have been with them for over a decade. They know WWT is the place to go to get the answers they need to make sure their businesses run right. The ATC is not only something the engineers at WWT use to spin up proofs of concept and pilots in their lab environment, but they also have set it up so customers can do it too. On-demand, schedulable labs for WWT's customers. Things like Dell's VxRail Power Store, Unity PowerMax, Data Protection Central, IDPA. These labs represent the newest advances in primary storage. Hundreds of labs that you can schedule and use from anywhere in the world 24/7. It's lab as a service, they call it. A dedicated lab space within the Advanced Technology Center where you can perform your own programmatic testing using that amazing ATC technology ecosystem. WWT's engineers work in this amazing place every day, beta testing new equipment, building reference architectures, and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment, too. But this digital platform they launched this last summer is incredible, encompasses the whole ecosystem. It really has created a multiplier effect, knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers and partners. So, by the way, you can go there, not just do the labs, there's full access if you sign up right now to articles, case studies, all the tools you need to make a difference in today's fast-paced world. So what do? You go to wwt.com/twit to learn more about the WWT, the Advanced Technology Center, to become a member of their growing community. wwt.com/twit. Create an account. Gain access to those on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. wwt.com/twit. Worldwide Technology, delivering business and technology outcomes all over the world from their great home in St. Louis. And I want to go back. It was a really nice trip. St. Louis is famous for toasted ravioli, which is unique.
That sounds delicious.
It actually is quite good. You guys seem like you're hip. You're with it. You're podcasters. You own your own microphones.
Let's go with yes.
Have you played with Clubhouse yet? Last week, iJustine sent me an invite, and I don't get it at all. They have 180 investors. They just raised more money through Andreessen Horowitz. Their valuation, they're a unicorn, $1 billion, which is 10 times more than it was from the previous round. Do you know what Clubhouse is? Louise, have you used Clubhouse?
So I have not used it. However, to pull my rest of world angle, I was very interested to learn the other day that it's also taking off in Mexico and Nigeria and some other places.
Interesting.
So they do seem to sort of have a larger user base than I thought. Because it's all sort of invite only right now.
Yeah, and it felt like it's all like VCs and startup guys, right?
Yeah. So to be fair, you know, Nigeria has a really big tech scene, and in Mexico, it's catching on amongst sort of like VC-ish people. So I do think that, like, you know, they're capturing the same types. I don't think it's, you know, attracting TikTok's user base or anything like that. But I was sort of surprised to hear that, because it definitely has this reputation as sort of, you know, not the nicest people in Silicon Valley. Some of the, like, you know, loudest voices maybe love to go on there. And it's sort of become like the reputation on Twitter, at least of Clubhouse, is that a lot of the conversations are like sort of very SF centric. But I think, you know, it's probably a wider platform than that. It's very buzzy. So it doesn't surprise me.
It's so buzzy.
More funding.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have an invite, and I was very jealous when Justine was.
I will send you one, Patrick. I have a few left.
Thank you. I would love to. I'd love to give it a try, actually, because I think there might be some kind of logic behind the unicorn status. Everyone has seen what TikTok has done, and TikTok was really a different kind of social network, and Clubhouse is the only new/different thing that's happened in social networking in the past, well, 5 years, if you exclude TikTok. So I'm thinking there's a lot of people who saw what happened with TikTok and who are thinking, of course, it's not the same thing, but it's different from everything we have right now. And they're thinking we might not want to miss the boat on this one. Could be something, could not be. And of course, there are a lot of issues with moderation and stuff like that. But it's definitely not something that we've seen in the past, you know, ever. It's a different kind of network.
I don't get it. I'll be honest with you.
It reminds me of the radio, though, right? Like, it sort of reminds me of, like, people calling into radio shows. It's a little bit more dynamic than that. But I feel like there is sort of a precedent here for this sort of, like, kind of, you know, social interaction, right? Like, it seems like an evolution of that, which is interesting. And I think potentially does have a lot of potential.
Anyone, just like if with Twitter, anyone can be their own publisher, kind of, or Facebook. This, anyone can be their own radio show very easy. And even isn't Twitter kind of copying the functionality with Spaces, which they're trialing now with actually minorities, which is probably a good idea because they want to catch the potential issues with the service. But
I find the valuation massively unsurprising, because you've got a giant body of VCs and investors and people using this system already.
Yeah.
Saying it's great. So, of course, they're going to throw a load of money into it. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. They, you know, it's being propped up by the fact that the people investing in it are the ones who are using it. Kind of like, I don't know, the early days of Twitter felt like, you know, a similar sort of buzz, that it was used by a lot of the people who are investing in it. But there does seem to be something a little different about it this time, just because it does seem to be spreading, and you're seeing new stories come out of things that happened on in Clubhouse. And that tends to be the point that I get interested in thinking, okay, is this more of a fad? Like, look at House Party. Remember House Party? It was a big deal for like a day.
Yeah.
Because it offered a new way for people to communicate that was exciting, but it was not a sticky product. What is it? Where is it now, really? It's not at the top of the app stores anymore, that's for sure. Certainly not in the countries I've seen.
Yeah.
So, that was also so based upon like your own network. And I think that sort of social network we're starting to realize is really hard in the long term, right? Like, Facebook's running into issues with that. Snapchat is running into issues with that. Now they're trying to get creators again. I think ultimately to have like a long-term successful platform, you can't just base it on people you know in real life. It's just like not sticky enough, and it's not going to keep people long enough because they have other ways of talking to their friends and family. And I think that that's one reason that Clubhouse is a little bit more promising. But I do agree. Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen to
it? I'm just too chicken to use it.
It is sort of intimate, right? Like, it's, yeah. I don't know. But the idea of like turning on these like freewheeling conversations is like not inherently appealing.
For
but...
people who don't know, you go into Clubhouse and you get a list of, I don't, it's hard to describe, but
rooms.
They're like chat rooms, but it's all audio. There's a moderator who's doing all the talking, but you can raise your hand and ask to be voiced, and then you can communicate. Otherwise, you can listen. There's a lot of these rooms have hundreds of people in them, but you can't record it. It's live only. It's completely ephemeral, which I guess is part of the appeal to some of these to startup folks and VCs and stuff. In fact, that's one of the things iJustine said last week is you hear people being extremely candid because they know it's not recorded. It's like Snapchat. It's like Snapchat. It just disappears. Of course, as somebody in the chat room is pointing out, everything can be recorded. So, but you're not supposed to. And since your name is on it, maybe you don't want to.
I mean, it sounds a little bit like a podcast in a way.
Yeah, it sounds like an ephemeral podcast.
We're doing it now. You can see me. If I put my hand up and say, you know, yeah. I want to say something, and interrupt you, then sometimes I do, and that's okay because that's what we're doing here. And it seems like, is that not the same thing for a different audience, obviously? But you could theoretically, as far as I am aware, you could set up a Clubhouse, and you could talk, and listeners could chime in.
Yeah.
And,
I could.
That's great. We know we want that. That's a cool idea.
But you could do it with discourse. You could do it. There's lots of ways to do something like that, right?
Yeah, I don't think the idea of audio conversations is what is making the product interesting. The idea, it's the ease of use and execution. Just like with Twitter, you could send a message to someone or to several people in a myriad of different ways before. Twitter didn't invent that. It's just the form that it took that was compelling, and the ease of use was so that everyone started using it. So I think it would be a mistake to look at Clubhouse and say, oh, but we can do that somewhere else. I mean, I don't know that it would be a mistake. Maybe it is just going to go away because it's really not creating.
Maybe I'm just too old. I feel like there's a scale of usability in these things. So if you go to Facebook, it's pretty clear, or Instagram is even clearer. I get it. I understand it. I know how to participate. No big deal. Then there's Twitter, which, you know, I mean, I've been on it since forever, but I think people looking at it go, I don't understand. It's a little strange. And then there's Clubhouse, which is far on the end of that scale, which even maybe I'm just old. I look at it and I go, I don't want to sit and listen to somebody gas on for hours. Wait a minute. That's my show. I want to come to think of it. Never mind. Forget I said anything. It's a fabulous idea. Well worth a billion.
Can anyone create a room, though?
Once you're a member, you have to be. It's invite
right,
only.
So that's very different, I think, from other forms of communication. It's Twitter for voice, and that's been kind of we have Twitter for photos, Instagram and many others. We have just short messages, but for voice, that has never taken off anywhere. And if they crack that, I think there's value there.
So let me tell you what I'm seeing. Right now, Baratunde, who I actually love and would listen to, says he's got 14 people listening, literally streaming Spotify Daily Mix while I work. Okay. YouTube Business SEO and IG, there's 12 people in there, including people I know who are smart. Oh, here's one. The Power Circle, Secrets of the Millionaire Mind, Master the Game of Wealth. There's 831 people in there, including some people I know also. Psychedelic Clubhouse, investing in psychedelics, the big opportunity. There's a lot of stuff like that.
I mean, what was YouTube when it first launched?
True.
It was skateboarding dogs what was Twitter when it first launched? I don't even remember. It was so memorable. It's, there's, this is, I don't think we should judge it by what it is now. And of course, if we knew it was going to be successful, we wouldn't be discussing the idiocy of yet another unicorn. But it is a bet, of course, and it could become something.
You're our resident optimist today, Patrick. I like you.
I like to think of myself as a realist. I've read Factfulness. It's an amazing book, and you have to look at things in a measured way and not in a negative way like everyone always does.
Good. Thank you. That's a good warning. In fact, here's a room if I weren't doing a show, I'd be listening to How to Be Successful on Clubhouse, and there's 243 people in there. I don't know how to do an invite. I will figure it out, and I guess send it to your email. I don't really know how this... Any of this works.
And at that point, I will understand why it's completely ridiculous.
If you were doing like the Phileas Club live, I would go listen to that. That would be great.
Well, I mean, that makes me think of Discord, which maybe you mentioned before.
Discord is exactly the same as far as I could tell.
Yes.
Very similar.
And people watch stuff on Discord. I mean, gaming, we've already had all of the people making fun of, oh, you're watching people game, and that's we've had that round already. But if you go look at Discord,
that's
some
good
people
point.
Watch stuff that you
that's
would
a,
never believe would get an audience.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent
point. We record my podcast text message. We record that on Discord live, and very occasionally we'll pull people in who are listening. Like literally the show I recorded this morning, we had a pronunciation of a Dutch website because there were people who were borrowing other people's dogs from a website that let you borrow dogs. So they had an excuse
Brilliant.
To be outside because of the strict Dutch lockdown rules.
Oh, that's so clever.
It's clever, but I'll be honest, that's not what my brother, who I did the show with today, described it. So it's worth a listen. But we pulled somebody in who is listening live in the Discord to help us with some of the pronunciation.
Yeah, because no one can pronounce Dutch except
the Dutch stuff. Dutch yeah. People. So yeah. For situations like that, it's really handy. Just very quickly pull people in if they've got something to say. As a podcaster, it's super useful.
I'm actually we're kind of exploring ideas for this. So it's an interesting. I have to say, you're influencing me already, Patrick. I do love the idea of the internet trying new ways to communicate, not just kind of settling on the ones that already exist. I think that's exactly what should be going on the internet. So I apologize. And then there's Parler, which is, it's kind of ironic.
Is there,
I don't know. You did a story, Nate, that said that the Parler has reappeared with the help of Russia.
Yeah. So I was doing some reverse DNS digging to try and figure out where the servers were, and I found that it was using a service called DDoS Guard, which is operated by two Russian people, although the office I found was registered
It's in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But what it seems to be, although it is that was accurate, DDoS Guard isn't hosting. It's like a Cloudflare.
Right.
Equivalent from what I'm aware of.
Right.
So they're using that, but it pointed towards the cogs working in the background to suggest like things are moving. The domain also has moved. It's now being managed by Epic, but Epic with a K, EPIK, which also is the registrar for Gab.
Oh yeah.
So like there's things moving that suggests it's on its way. But at the time of speaking now, Parler.com at least still says technical difficulties. It's a very similar message to what was on the other day when I was reporting this at, for Bloomberg. But yeah, I'm keeping my eye on it quite closely.
CEO John Matzie, you quote saying from his post saying our return is inevitable. Due to hard work and persistence against all odds. That's a little bit of a change from his earlier story. I don't know how I'm going to get this back online. He says, despite the threats and harassment, not one Parler employee has quit. We are becoming closer and stronger as a team here in our bunker. Oh, no, I added the bunker part.
I can believe that. It's a small team. I think it probably will come back in some form. The question will be initially whether it comes back in a way that preserves the historic content. You know, is it your same account? If you have a problem, can you verify? Pardon me. It's late. To get back in, if you forgot your password or will you have to set up a new account? There's a lot of stuff like that that may mean that it loses some of the buzz perhaps that it had, but I do believe it'll probably come back because it had a lot of users.
I'm still a First Amendment absolutist. Obviously the First Amendment doesn't protect incitements to violence or planning violence or violent insurrection or sedition. And the problem Parler had was that they didn't seem to be able to take that stuff down. But I think there needs to be places like Gab and Parler. I'm not going to hang out there, but I think everybody should have the right to express their opinion, right?
Well, no, I'm sorry. Not everybody.
This is the European versus the American debate.
Let me just go first.
I'm sorry. Everybody, you don't think everybody should have a right to express their opinion. If there is, you know, terrorism or child abuse.
No. There are certain things that are illegal that shouldn't, you know, like incitement to violence or child abuse that absolutely should not be expressed. But if you want to say, I think President Trump won the election and it's a damn shame that it was stolen from him, you should have the right to say that.
Yes.
I think you do, though. Do you not have the right to say that?
It's absolutely protected.
I think the question is sort of like these platforms are given a lot of credit in these discussions. Like, let's look at what Parler is, right? It was funded by, you know, a very politically oriented conservative family. They were collecting people's driver's license, you know, very sensitive information. You know, is this really the free speech network that we want to be in a position of defending?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm happy to talk about these things sort of like in an idealistic way. And I think that like, this is just the wrong example. And I know it's like, yeah, you want to use the hard examples, but I have so much more of a problem with governments wanting speech taken down that is, you know, a threat to their rule. There's just so many more pressing cases of this than Parler. Like Parler, to me, it's just so obvious that, you know, I think they were trying to collect a bunch of data about conservatives primarily. It was really sensitive data. Like, what was the aim here? Was the aim here really to give people an alternative because Twitter is so, you know, authoritarian? Or was it to create sort of a safe space for conservatives where a lot of, like, you know, marketing could be done for conservative causes?
Oh, that's depressing if that's the case. You know,
it's hard to say. I just don't know.
There's a lot of that in the world. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that in the world on every political
I just look
spectrum.
At something like Mastodon or like some of these other sites like Minds, like some of these other ones where I'm like, okay, it seems like more like the people behind this are really thinking about
I love Mastodon.
Actual free speech.
Yeah. We have our own Mastodon instance, which I run, called twit.social. And it's the only issue is I wish there were more people there, but it's a great place. And by the way, Gab uses Mastodon. And on my instance, I block Gab because I don't want to get in that kind of conversation. But you can always go to Gab if you want on Mastodon. And there are probably plenty of people.
And God bless the Mastodon enthusiasts. They are like, this is it could create issues at some point, but it's a genuine effort. I think the bigger problem we're going to see with Parler is the same as with Gab and with what's the name of that Reddit alternative, like the free speech / conservative alternative to Reddit. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. But that's the thing. You don't even remember it either. The problem with these efforts is that they portray to be defending free speech, but really what they are, let's be honest, is enabling a pretty unacceptable kind of speech that would be banned everywhere else. And the real problem is there's no business model for that. They can't monetize. First of all, it's not interesting because they're talking amongst themselves. So they aren't very many that stay there because it's only.
But Fox News monetizes, Breitbart monetizes. There are plenty of far right journalistic enterprises
that monetize. Yeah, but they're not that kind of far right. I don't think. I think you can
express not extremist, not extremist.
Express,
okay.
Yeah, Fox News. You can you know express those views on Twitter.
Right.
That's can go there. The things that you see on Gab and on Parler are maybe Parler is kind of a edge case because it rose to prominence during the last few months of the Trump administration. I don't think long term that is a viable business model. There's a viable business model behind that kind of a target. Maybe I'm wrong, but the history so far has shown that all of those things tend to go away, not because they're being censored, but because there isn't really anyone who wants to do business with them, and they don't have any other ways to monetize them.
That was Mike Masnick's point on Tech Dirt. He says, this isn't censorship. It's the free market weighing in on the viability of a product, and nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. So that's that. There's that. Exactly. That's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was a very insightful article. Like, I do feel sort of weird about, AWS having a say in what is on the internet, right?
Yeah.
I think there are problems with how Apple and Google have policed the App Store, right? We've seen Apple take down an app that, raised awareness about how workers are treated in Foxconn, right? Like, there are, problems there with sort of these systems, but I don't necessarily think, again, that these are the best examples necessarily. I think that there's a genuine business reason, to your point, that they wouldn't want to work with these companies, and that sort of raises a lot of questions about, is this a viable business?
I mean, well, you're never going to get massive advertisers flocking to something like Parler, right? It was always going to attract more of a niche audience, and we've seen that just when massive advertisers have pulled their campaigns from Facebook when they've seen that their ads were appearing next to something that promoted something awful or that was against their corporate values or whatever. But Parler was ad funded. Like, that was their model, was to make money from ads. So I wonder if at such point it does come back, whether it can self-sustain as a donation-based system, because you've got a very loyal group of people who seem to really want this to exist. And maybe that's how it survives. Maybe it just has to do everything itself and the community wants it. If they feel so removed from some of these other platforms, maybe they're like, well, hell, this is the thing that we want, so we'll pay for it.
Honestly,
and they don't need ads at all.
There's no stigma about not being able to self-fund through selling advertising. Absolutely right. Why not have a subscription? I think that's actually a completely honorable way to go. I mean, we're ad funded, but if something wants to exist and people want it to exist, having them contribute a few bucks to keep it alive is, I think, a kind of a pure model, really.
That's what Gab does.
Yeah.
Is the Gab
and
model.
Is it really? I didn't realize
that. They have
actually.
Gab Pro version that's sort of how they're doing it. And they've sort of found a lot of alternatives. I'm not, defending them necessarily, but I do think that that's fair. And that's always going to be sort of a niche approach, right? You're not going to scale that, very, very far, I don't think. There's a limited number of people who are willing to pay a monthly or yearly fee for that sort of access.
This is what I wonder about with Signal. And I've become a massive Signal advocate over the last few months. But similar, like that, they have designed themselves around the idea of being funded by a not-for-profit foundation that relies on donations. And I was thinking, well, what's the good example of that being, working well in these sorts of spheres? And then I think Wikipedia has done quite nicely. The Internet Archive has done very nicely. So it can work. It can totally work if there's value, and I think that's what Paul is going to have to do.
Yeah, it can. The issue you have there is that the target for Parler is people who can't express themselves on other platforms. It's the exact same service, except for people who can't say what they want to say on other platforms. And my theory, and I think I'm Mike Masnick's article was very close to that, is that this isn't really this big divide in the middle. It is because we have a complete statistical anomaly with what happened with President Trump's deplatforming. And that made a lot of noise. But the reality of the situation is that that group that can't say what they want on the, general platforms is very small. So I don't think you're going to find a lot of, and I would guess maybe I'm wrong, but I would guess not a lot of them are going to be funding or donating to these platforms on the long run. So
I don't think there's a natural alliance between like other groups that do have these problems, right? Like, I don't think you see sex workers or you see, you know, activists who are often sort of kicked off these platforms or like have problems with moderation. Like, they don't want to be in these platforms either, right? Like, they're not necessarily just attracting the free speech people or the people who have grievances with the big platforms. They're attracting like even a smaller subset of that.
And an even bigger problem I think we're going to see is not Parler. What we're going to see is what actually Nate mentioned, things like Signal and Telegram and the other, you know, end-to-end encryption services,
WhatsApp,
which are exactly, for example, which are going to have to start dealing. But WhatsApp, they can kind of police things a little bit more easily. I think something like Signal is going to have a hard time moderating these groups if they start adopting Signal massively.
It's
I don't know what it's a
huge problem for Telegram, right?
Yes,
yeah, Telegram
exactly.
Though has a little bit more, I think, you know, culpability in that, because the Telegram channels by default are not end-to-end encrypted, right? So they have some, you know, visibility into them.
Yeah,
whereas Signal really is sort of just like, we don't know it's what's going on the platform, which I think is sort of an existential question.
It's unmoderatable, therefore, and so they're off the hook, right? By design.
By design. But that's the thing. I think that's the point where we're going to start seeing in the next, I don't know, year, 2 years, 5 years, encryption advocates and absolutists who might have to start thinking about that idea because...
Never.
WhatsApp has already had this problem, right? They've had this problem in India. They've had this problem in places like the Philippines. And what WhatsApp has done is they've made a couple of like tweaks around the edges, right? So like they have, you know, limited the amount that you can forward messages, for example, since they realized that like, you know, forward chain messages were a big source of this stuff. But I think you can only sort of work around the edges if you want to keep the end-to-end encryption in place. There's a lot of reasons for that. And that's going to be really tricky.
That's a really good point, because you're right. Part of the reason that that was such a problem for WhatsApp is that it's so pervasive and it's at such a giant scale. And there was no filtering in the way that posts sometimes, just because of the algorithm, don't appear in your feed on Facebook. With WhatsApp, you get everything. There's no algorithm deciding which messages from which people you get. You get everything. So it had that power to spread, like, I don't want to use like virus because... bad connotations right now. But, you know,
like wildfire, maybe.
Yeah.
The greatest connotations here either.
No, that's true. All right. It spread very, very quickly. But that most platforms aren't at that scale. And so it will be interesting if something like Signal got to that middle ground where it was big enough to be a problem, but not so big that they had to force something like WhatsApp did to keep it under control.
Yeah.
But just one final thing that I wanted to mention on Parler will be a really interesting test case if it is possible for a very liberal or, you know, very left-leaning conversation or person or topic or something to rise to the forefront in that app, or whether it will just naturally and organically get buried simply because the people who want to use it don't want to read that stuff, or they want to, you know, push that kind of content down, disagree with it. It'll be really interesting if we ever see a prominent liberal voice, I suppose, is what I'm getting at, on Parler.
They don't need it. They can speak on Twitter, and then you're going to have people who are going to say, oh, but see, that's proof of bias. But it isn't. It's society as a whole deciding what's acceptable and what isn't. That's exactly, again, getting back to that, Masnik's point. It's us together. It wasn't Twitter and Facebook Illuminatis getting together in a room and saying, we're going to ban this and this and this word. It looked like this in form because that's the way it happened, but it was really much wider than that. It was society saying, all right, that's it. Now we say stop. And we was society that took the form of public pressure on many, many different companies that pushed that kind of speech to the edges. So the left-wing prominent voices can still say what they want on Twitter, I think. It's a different, you know, I'm all for both sides. Really, like, the Phileas Club is essentially a both sides podcast. It's very important to me, and it's very important that we listen to everyone. I think that's key to the future. But this, I don't think, is a, you know, you can equate.
Well, because these are private companies. They're just businesses. Is that why?
No, I mean, what I mean is, it's not, when we take the example of, will, you know, on those free speech platforms, will left-leaning voices rise to prominence? I don't think they will, because they don't need those quote-unquote free speech platforms. Those platforms are created to host speech that is unacceptable to
fringe
society.
Fringy speech.
Yeah. And those left-leaning figures can say what they want on the, you know, existing platforms, so they don't need to go there.
What about MeWe? This is a alternative social network designed to replace Facebook. Tim Berners-Lee was very much involved with it, and apparently becoming a haven also for extremist far right activity. Is there something about social networks that causes what's going on? Or, you know, what's happened is you squeeze so hard on the mainstream networks that the jam is coming out of the sandwich, and it's spreading to wherever it can flow.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what you're sort of seeing here. I also think that there is some sort of over coverage to some degree, because, like, you know, it's like these are the people who are getting kicked off that are getting a lot
right.
of notice.
They get press, you know, so it doesn't mean it's a big deal. It's just it's getting coverage. Yeah.
I mean, I think it is like a big swath of users, right? It's like, you know, I think Twitter kicked off 70,000 QAnon people
right.
one day. Like, that's, you know, a sizable chunk of people. You know, it's a little disturbing that there was that many accounts that they could sort of automatically identify as being associated with QAnon, but that's sort of a separate topic. So I do think there is sort of a big base, but I do think, you know, there's always some people who are looking for another place. It's just that this purge also happened to be occurring, to your point, Leo. I think that the, you know, the sandwich was getting squeezed. It's a terrible metaphor.
It's a terrible metaphor, and I totally apologize for it. But there
it's,
it is.
I think it's apt. It's apt.
Thank you for defending my crappy metaphor. What is now Facebook? This is what, by the way, the oversight board was invented for. Facebook, of all of these companies, can say, "Well, you know, we're going to deplatform the president, but indefinitely on Facebook and Instagram." But we're going to refer it to the Facebook Oversight Board. And, of course, they have no – they can say whatever they want. It doesn't force Facebook to listen to it. It really is a mechanism for deferring responsibility. And the Facebook Oversight Board has agreed to take it. I don't know how long this is going to take. Its decisions, they say, are binding and cannot be overruled by Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know. Is that the case?
It reminds me of when they did the voting on the privacy policy updates, and they said that if certain things got a high enough engagement from users that it could force a review or a change or something like that. But I don't think enough people ever actually cared enough for it to tip the threshold of, you know, tip the balance. So I don't know why something like this would be any more effective than that. It's just, as you say, it's batting responsibility. It's going to slow down decisions, presumably. It seems like a strange decision, but I also think it's strange because I don't fully understand it, and I'm very aware of that. Maybe one of you guys do, but
I think the way that this works is it's always an appeal, right? Like, I think it's always a decision that Facebook first made that then gets referred to the oversight board.
Yeah.
So I think that that's why it happened afterward. And I do think this is going to be fascinating because Techter did a really good experiment a while ago where they asked a bunch of content moderation experts about what they thought about, you know, various decisions. And I think that the way that sort of shook out is that they had different answers, like people who, you know, specialize in this stuff, which points to the fact that there is sort of no right and wrong answer. And I would love to sort of just see their responses and whether there are disagreements, because I think that the, you know, common wisdom here is that this was the right move. Maybe it was a little too late. But I would like to see sort of some fleshed out arguments on both sides, because I think that this is a complicated question that, you know, does set precedent for what Facebook will do in the future, especially in the rest of the world. So I am really curious what will happen.
So according to the board, they are binding, although honestly, nothing's binding if Mark doesn't want to go with it. In the coming
days, so public, so.
Yeah, I mean, it would be embarrassing to overrule it. So in the coming days, according to the board, the case will be assigned to a 5-member case review panel. After the panel reaches a decision, its findings are shared with the entire board. Then a majority of the board will have to sign off for the case decision to be issued. Mr. Trump, through his designated page administrators, will have the ability to submit a statement to the board explaining why he believes Facebook's content moderation decisions should be overturned. Facebook will also share contextual information and an explanation. What they're reviewing, though, is kind of constrained. They are reviewing whether it was a violation of Facebook's own policies. In other words, they can't just say, no, you should put him back. The members will decide whether the content involved in this case violated Facebook's community standards and values. They will also consider whether Facebook's removal of the content respected international human rights standards, including freedom of expression and other human rights. So there is a kind of a framework for them to interpret this. They say they're going to move as promptly as possible. There's a 90-day limit, so I don't know what prompt means. Following publication, Facebook will have up to 7 days to implement the decision, and they also have to respond to any recommendations within 30 days. So I think in a way this sounds sensible. I mean, there's lots of issues with the oversight board. They can't review very many cases. There are millions that would like to be reviewed. They did pick good people to do it. So, you know what? I think I'll be interested to see what they say.
I think it's not an ideal solution, but once again, we don't have a better one.
Right.
I don't think anyone has a – we have a lot of critics, but very few people are actually saying that's the way we should do it. And the oversight board isn't it's probably – I genuinely think it's the best hint of a path forward right. for these kinds of decisions.
Right.
Now, of course, they could really make the decision either way, and a lot of people are going to be happy about it, and a lot of people are going to say that this is the worst decision ever made, or that they were in the pocket of Zuckerberg anyway from the get-go,
right.
or, you know, I would be very surprised if they overturned it, but who knows.
All right, let's take a little break. Got a great panel, I don't want to exhaust you because it's late at night, both in the UK and Finland. So we're moving through this as quickly as possible. Nate Langston is here. He is a tech editor at Bloomberg, host of the UK Tech Show. Wonderful to have you, Nate. If you want to do a little paradiddle on your drums, please be my guest anytime. Also joining us, Louise Matsakis from a brand new, well, to me new, it's been around for 9 months, publication, Rest of World, the global tech stories that get underreported in the U.S. and Europe. I think this is great. Restofworld.org. It's great to have you, Louise. And my friend, Not Patrick, from notpatrick.com. There's so many podcasts, the Phileas Club. If I go to notpatrick.com, all of them will be there, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Everything I do.
Okay. We had a fun week this week on Twit. We've actually prepared a short movie to help you, if you missed anything, get an idea of what you might have missed. Watch. This was from this morning. Bernie sitting wearing these mittens, and now they're putting him everywhere. He's sitting behind Jeff.
Previously on Twit. Hands on Tech.
Retro video game consoles are pretty awesome, but I just got the one that I've been anticipating the most. I'm going to review the C64 by Retro Games next.
Windows Weekly.
I am getting more and more excited about Windows 10X.
I think a better name for this would have been EdgeOS. It really would have been.
Oh, but interesting. Then, yeah. Like Chrome
but
OS.
Then.
Oh, it's not just like Chrome OS. It's not as good. See, that's the problem.
So. This Week in Enterprise Tech.
In Parler's case, I think it's a case of not being as concerned with privacy as they said they were, and not being nearly as skilled at programming as they should have been.
How many of you remember that IT guy for Jurassic Park? Yeah. I think our friends at Parler were building Jurassic Park on cheap. What do you think?
Twit. Line 10, print I love Twit. Line 20, go to line 10.
Man, you don't. There are not many places you'll hear some basic programming in the promo. Thank you, Jim Cutler, the great Jim Cutler, our official pro bono VO guy, does a great job. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. One thing we learned last year: the internet is even more awesome, more useful. Anyway, if you can't go to the grocery store, buy groceries online. Can't watch movies in a theater, watch movies online. Can't go to the doctor, visit the doctor online. And of course, if you need stamps, you don't have to go to the post office. You can go to stamps.com. We've been using them for years. Stamps.com has saved small businesses all over the country thousands of hours and tons of money. They could save you, too. We've got an amazing bonus offer here. I'll tell you about that in a second. But let me tell you what stamps.com does. It allows you to do all your mailing and shipping without leaving your desk, using your computer, your printer. You don't need a postage meter. You don't need special ink. You don't have to leave the home or office or home office. You get all the services of the U.S. Postal Service at your desk. And by the way, now UPS, the United Parcel Service as well. And you get big discounts on both. Both on mailing and shipping rates, whether you're a small office just sending out brochures or invoices, an online seller shipping out orders, even a giant warehouse sending thousands of packages a day, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. They don't just print out stamps. They print labels right for the, you know, with a proper postage. We're going to show you, get a USB scale, so you'll always know exactly what the right postage is. You just use your computer to print official U.S. postage anytime you need it for any letter, any package, any class of mail, no matter where you're sending it, anywhere in the world. And I love it because once your mail is ready, you just schedule a pickup or you could drop it off in a mailbox and boom, you're good to go. The discounts are really mind-bending. With Stamps.com, 5 cents off every first-class stamp, up to 40% off priority mail. In UPS, man, even more, up to 62% off UPS shipping rates. No wonder over 900,000 small businesses like ours use Stamps.com. We've been using them for almost a decade now. What are you waiting for? Make 2021 the year you stop going to the post office and use Stamps.com instead. We've got a great deal for you. No risk trial. What you do is you go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, enter the offer code TWIT. You'll get an offer that includes not only a 4-week trial of Stamps.com, but $55 in free postage, a free digital scale. You just pay shipping and handling. No long-term commitments, no contracts, just a great deal on Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com. Click the top right-hand corner of the homepage. Type into it. That's all you have to do. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Not that the post office isn't great. I love the post office. I'll probably go in and wave at them, say hello. But when I need postage, I'm going to use Stamps.com. You should too. Stamps.com. Please use that offer code TWIT so they know you saw it here. Stamps.com. Thank you, Stamps.com. Big quarter for Netflix. What a surprise, right? I mean, that's all we're doing is watching Netflix. Big subscriber growth. I didn't realize how big Netflix was internationally. I should have known. But the growth was even greater worldwide. The subscriber growth in the U.S. and Canada and around the world, 200 million paid subscribers. It crossed 100 million 2 years ago. Now it's at 200 million. And even more importantly, I didn't know this, Netflix, for the first time ever, has enough money they don't have to borrow to continue operations. Did you know they were borrowing to keep it going? They're going to be free cash flow positive. That's the term they use. They won't have to do any more borrowing. They do have a lot of debt, but they'll be able to pay a lot down. They've borrowed $15 billion since 2011. But they have
so much money.
Isn't that amazing? I had no idea. They have $8.2 billion cash on hand, though. So this is good news. Good news. Even with in the face of competition from Apple TV and Disney Plus and Discovery Plus and HBO Max and on and on and on. Go ahead, Nate.
It's definitely a sign that original content strategy works and has worked for them. You know, there was a lot of comparisons to HBO initially and how that worked very well for HBO. But it seems like such a long time ago that whenever you thought of Netflix, the only show that came to mind was either House of Cards or Orange is the New Black. Because for the longest time, they were among the only original pieces of content that you had on Netflix. And when was the last time anyone described Netflix as being the kind of bargain bucket of video rentals? You know, I mean, it's certainly how we used to describe it here, that if there was nothing else that you wanted to watch, you'd go to Netflix.
Right.
You know, it was all junk, but it was fine because sometimes you're in the mood for junk.
Right.
It's just so not the case anymore and hasn't been for years. It's amazing. So unsurprising, but now there's a lot more competition.
Well, and another testament to their success is the fact that every other streaming service is copying it. HBO Max, when AT&T bought Time Warner or Warner Media, whatever it's called, the new guy came in and said, we're going to be more like Netflix. And they
are. We've got a really interesting situation in the UK where we've got both our state broadcaster, the BBC, as well as a couple of the commercial broadcasters, including ITV, that have teamed up, even though they're technically commercial rivals, they've teamed up to launch a streaming service. It's called BritBox.
I subscribe and love it.
Okay, interesting. I'm in Britain and I don't.
You don't need it.
This is the thing. But they push it at us. Like,
oh, really?
If you sign up for wireless phone plans, often it's BritBox is an option right up there with Amazon Prime or Disney Plus or something. So and I have used it, but I let a trial lapse because I just wasn't watching enough on it. But the fact is that that's the kind of competition that Netflix's success has forced in regional markets. So, I mean, I say regional markets, one regional market, but I imagine similar is playing out in other parts of the world as well, that maybe Louise is more familiar with than I am. But that's the kind of thing that's actually been very good for everyone as far as making content available is concerned, because we've just got decades of shows that you cannot buy. You can maybe download them or get them on YouTube somewhere, you know, it's a bit of a gray area, but it's forced them to go through these archives, bring stuff back. And there's some great TV shows that I've watched that I never would have even known about, let alone had access to. And that's a byproduct of Netflix's success.
And the other thing Netflix is going out of business, has done well is they're buying international stuff and they're showing up as Netflix originals, but something like Berlin Babylon, which is produced in Germany, is such high quality content.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't see it otherwise, I don't think, in the US.
Yeah, I think so. That brings up a really great point, which is like, what don't you see when things are not on Netflix, right? So one thing I worry about with Netflix, you know, Amazon Studios, these big international companies with gigantic international presences kind of being, you know, some of the only buyers of original content. Like, I look at what happened with The Dissident, right? This, you know, extremely acclaimed documentary by a very famous director, but it's about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, right? So, you know, they had a really hard time getting that bought, right? And this is an Oscar-winning documentarian. You know, of course, documentary is always going to be a little niche. It's not going to be The House of Cards. It's not going to be The Orange is the New Black. But I do worry when there's only, like, you know, I'm really in favor of things like BritBox because, you know, that's the kind of, you know, more niche carrier that I think would want some of the stuff that, you know, maybe Netflix doesn't want to touch because Netflix wants to keep gaining new users where it can, right? Like, that's sort of the problem when you're that big is that you need to please everyone. And we've seen all of these big streaming companies not want stuff that's not kind to China, right? You know, Apple won't touch that. You're never going to see sort of a critical movie about China. And that's also true of, you know, in big box offices. So that's what I worry about with these companies going really global. So I want more stuff like BritBox. I want some of these local
niche
players.
Stuff. Yeah.
And like, you know, Netflix tries to be, but they're never going to pick up the really niche stuff. And I want them to, and I want there to be space for that.
That's why I subscribe to BritBox and the Criterion channel, which has a lot of art house films and things like that.
Criterion's great, yeah. But it's amazing hearing Louise describe that because you can use the same description as we did with Parler and Twitter. It's like BritBox is the Parler of video streaming. It's a place where the niche. Don't make that the show title. That'd be awful. But you know what I mean.
There's problems with Monopoly, right? And I think that's sort of what you're picking up on. There's definitely problems with Monopoly, and there's problems about content. But you know, I do think there's a little difference between, like, I think Netflix and, you know, Apple's new what's it called, Apple TV. You know, they don't want to be blocked in some of these countries, and that sort of seems like a slightly different political calculus. But I do hear what you're saying. It's like, I think that there's, you know, a downside to these companies getting too big.
Well, but there is an upside, which is, for years, part of the problem was regional content restrictions. And all of this streaming has really broken that down now.
You still see that, though. Like, if you try to use Netflix in the UK, there's certain stuff that's going to be blocked because of, like, you know, whatever.
But there's ways around it.
There's more ways.
So they're not monolithic. So it's good not to. That's a very interesting point you made, because in the same way that there's monolithic big tech companies dominating social media, I guess there's monolithic streaming media companies. But it's important to keep these, as you say, Louise, keep these small niche companies around so that we get to see more variety.
I think it's crazy, though, to see, like, basically big tech has taken over where I'm right now, right?
Everything.
L.A.
Everything.
Like, they've taken over big Hollywood in a lot of ways, and they control so much more. Because, like, you know, I think for any emerging filmmaker at this point, like, getting a deal with Netflix is the dream, right? And that's kind of crazy when you think about it. Like,
it used to be Netflix HBO. Apple's hoping it'll be Apple someday. It's interesting, yeah. Netflix's biggest problem, apparently, is people can't figure out what to watch. They're introducing a feature, I already got it, called Shuffle Play. You press a button and it just picks something random.
I love this idea.
Is it random? Or is it?
Well, they say it's based on what your interests are. I haven't pressed it enough times to know how totally random. I mean, what I got was pretty mainstream. It wasn't like, oh, here's a weird documentary you never would have thought of watching.
love this.
Do you know
though.
What?
Do you? You like the idea?
I think it's great. I never know what to watch.
Right.
I absolutely love it. And for quite a while, quite a few years ago now, at this point, back when we had, you know, some people still do have media servers under their cabinets, but I used to have like a bunch of stuff that was entirely legitimately ripped from DVDs, etc. That I would just have cycling through, so I could switch a TV to a channel on and just watch whatever happened to be playing, because it was just all my own stuff, 10 minutes here, 5 minutes there, whatever. And that was really, really great, but that doesn't exist anymore because all of my consumption is from cloud stuff. So I really like this idea, but what I specifically want is to be able to make my own playlist that when I press play, it's only shuffling stuff that I've added into a playlist. Because that way I know what I'm getting. Whereas this seems to be the entire catalog.
Is Netflix going to become more and more like Spotify? So you have that's an interesting
idea.
That's
what I'd want.
Yeah.
That's what I'd want.
Yeah. A clever idea. Cruise, the self-driving vehicle startup from GM, just did another round of investment. $2 billion round. Microsoft was one of the investors. We don't know how much, but the thought is about $500 million. Its valuation now $30 billion. These cruise vehicles are driverless. They don't have a safety driver even. It's just like a living room on wheels. And GM is putting a lot of money into this. It'll be very interesting to see where they go. Would you drive, Louise? Would you, if you called a cab or a Spotify or an Uber and it pulled up and there was nobody in it, would you hop in and take off?
I think I sort of trust the idea. I think that it's probably better than a normal driver in the long run. I think that there's a lot of problems with the technology that need to be hammered out. But, you know, I'm also not a good driver. I'm a huge advocate of public transportation. And I think I worry about in the long term how these things will be democratized. Because I would like to see a world where we're all using cars less, not that we're using AI cars. So I do sort of worry about what's the path we're getting on. But I do think like it's probably better. But I just worry like we're going to have this world where like if you're, you know, a little bit richer, you get the AI Uber first and then everyone else is still using the normal bus. And then public transportation is even more screwed. Like I want to like, what about the AI bus? You know what I mean? Like that's what I want sort of first before the AI car.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Or have some of this be like a little bit more like ensure that we're really supporting people. But, you know, I would take an AI electric car. That sounds like an improvement over what we have right now.
Somebody's saying that they should have a shuffle button in the AI cab that you just press a button. You don't know where you're going to go. You just press a button and you go somewhere.
Can you imagine like the restaurants paying to be part of that feature?
Oh,
that's a model.
Actually,
right there, okay?
Bring me to a restaurant. You do that with a cab. You say, what's a good restaurant in town? Take me there. He gets $5. You get a good restaurant. Maybe not. I don't know.
I think that there's, you know, that could be kind of fun, honestly. I would like to see some of this like interesting AI personalization brought into the real world, quote unquote.
I know
they could do that with the ordering services. They could do it today.
Yeah, just, shuffle button.
Just don't go to the restaurant. Just get surprise food.
Shuffle that button. Work. I don't know what I'm going to get. Yeah. Just bring it to me.
God, I'd hate that. I'm the worst. I'm the worst with food. Like,
are you picky?
If I order a burger, I don't want anything on it. And it never comes as plain as I want.
Never.
I don't want cheese on it.
Yeah.
Get rid of that mayo. Get rid of everything. And they say plain. I say plain. They say really plain. I say
really?
Plain. The burger comes and it's not plain. I'm like,
they don't understand why you would want that. That's why.
I know. And I know I'm the freak, but that's why I'd never press the shuffle button.
Never press the shuffle button.
In a restaurant. Yeah. Oh.
Adobe Flash is dead, but that's not necessarily a good thing, at least for one railroad in China. December 31st, Adobe killed Flash. But I think they didn't realize that they would also kill the railroad system in northern China in Dalian. It collapsed citywide for 20 hours. Apparently, the China Railway Shenyang was running on Flash. They were using Flash for train operation, for scheduling, for shunting. And when Flash stopped working, so did the railroad. You would think, knowing that Flash was going away 3 years ago, they would have maybe planned better. Apparently not. However, good news, they were able to fix the issue by installing a pirated version of Flash, and they were back up running the next day.
Amazing.
I love that.
Speaking of China, you had a great story on, who knew this? This is why I love Rest of World, because we're learning about stuff. The cutthroat war to dominate China's grocery delivery industry. Is there a grocery delivery industry in China? I don't know why. I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah. So, okay. Follow me for a second. This is a really crazy model that like 100 million people plus are using in China right now. So it's really big and it's really, really innovative. And it's attracting sort of like grandmas, almost like aunties, people who are really price conscious. So imagine you have a group chat and all of your neighbors are in that group chat and you have sort of like, you know, maybe a local stay-at-home mom or someone, you know, maybe the local corner store owner, someone who, you know, owns a 7-Eleven, and they are the moderator of that group chat. And every single day they give you some crazy deals for fresh food. And all you have to do is in that group chat, say what you want. And the next day, the stay-at-home mom will get it all delivered to her place and then she'll bring it to you or you go pick it up at the corner store. So they're called group buying groups. Basically.
So she gets everything and then parcels it out to her neighbors.
So the like Uber, so Didi, which is the Uber of China, is invested in this. You know, every Tencent, JD.com, Alibaba, all the biggest tech companies are investing in this all over the place. It's a huge frenzy to sort of like get all these people. Because to your point, these are people who didn't usually buy groceries online. They would just go to that corner store and get the stuff previously. But what this is doing is it's letting all those big tech companies cut a ton of costs. They get marketing from the stay-at-home mom. They get logistics. They don't have to go to each person's home, right? The stay-at-home mom will take care of that for them. So the problem
is she makes money too, right? She gets paid.
She gets about 5 to 10% commission. So she's incentivized to get, you know, as many people as possible. Most of these people have, you know, anywhere from a couple hundred to 900 people that they're managing. So it's huge for them.
Holy cow.
And it can be, you know, it can be a big source of business for them. And it's a crazy trend in China. And it's become, you know, really, really wild. Actually, two employees at one of the companies that has invested in this actually died recently, which sort of set off this huge reckoning about like, you know, are they pushing employees too hard at these companies? You know, is this frenzy worth it? The government is mad about it. But I love it because it's like stay-at-home mom selling vegetables, but everyone in tech is just falling over themselves over it.
Well, and as you point out, it's in the article, it's highly customized because this one person who is managing this group gets to know everybody, their interests, their tastes, what they want, what they don't like. So it works. It sounds like it works really well, I have to say.
Yeah. And like, come on, if your like cute little neighbor like texted you every day and was like, sale on carrots, are you kidding?
I would totally do it.
Yeah. 50 cents for a bundle of carrots. Like, come grab them tomorrow with your eggs and your milk or whatever. Of course I would do it.
Do you think this model could work in the rest of the world?
I think that, like, you know, when I think about someone like my mom, who's like not going to navigate Instacart probably, but, you know, knows how to use iMessage, the thing is that it's integrated into WeChat, right? And we don't really have that kind of integration here in the same way. So I think we're sort of far off. But I do think, you know, this is supercharged by the pandemic. There are way more people buying groceries online than there used to be. Right. And I think that Instacart is like ripe for disruption. I think that, like, you know, Whole Foods delivery is not doing anything particularly innovative. And I think that even Amazon and some of these logistics giants are still really struggling with how to make a profit off of this. And these Chinese companies have sort of, you know, figured out a way to do it. Although, to be fair, they're offering really, really low prices because these are really price conscious consumers, and suppliers are getting mad because they're like, you know, selling a bottle of cooking oil for like less than the actual, you know, cost to make it. So there are a lot of sort of, it reminds me of when it was like $2 to take an Uber anywhere because they were just pouring money on it, and you can get a 50% off Lyft ride if you just open the Uber app and the Lyft app, you know, noticed that you were doing that. We all remember this. It feels like that.
Yeah.
So I do worry it's sort of gimmicky.
Meanwhile, Instacart, which was bought by Uber, has announced they're going to lay off all their, everybody who works for them that voted for a union is fired. I thought that was illegal.
Wow, that's bold.
That is bizarre. It makes me say I'll never use Instacart. That's, I thought that, where's the NLRB in this? That sounds completely illegal. All right, nothing to say on that.
I mean, it sounds cool and that's it, yeah.
Yeah, maybe it is, maybe it's not, I don't know. Let's do one more quick break, and then because I'm feeling really guilty keeping you guys up so late. But here's the deal: today's advertiser is Casper, so this would be a good ad to kind of drowse off to. Casper is, of course, a maker of the best mattresses in the world, supportive, comfortable, but firm. It's hard to describe how it works, but it works so well. Mattresses that you sleep cool. They also have super soft bedding. My daughter just got a new apartment. I can't think of how many Caspers I've gone through, but I think I've bought almost everybody in my family a Casper mattress. I just bought my daughter the frame, the foundation, the mattress, the sheets, the pillows, everything. And it was a really good deal. I love our Casper mattresses. Casper mattresses are made with 86 supportive gel pods to align your spine and eliminate aches and pains. It's curiously supportive and yet soft. So you wake refreshed and ready to go. The Wave Hybrid I'm opening here. Actually, I think this is the Wave Hybrid. It's perfect for people who have aches and pains and want a mattress with maximum support and cooling. And yet, do you see how comfy that looks? For the most plush mattress, check out the Nova Hybrid with a plush feel that doesn't sacrifice support. Or what I got my daughter, the original mattress for sleepers who want both support and cooling. And you know what? She loves it. I love my original Casper pillow. It's made with a unique pillow and pillow design. Soft on the outside, supportive on the inside. I got the king size, and it is, I just wrap myself around it every night. And you know that feeling when you go to bed and you got great sheets and great pillows and a great mattress, and you just, I get that every night. I just love that. Casper makes everything you need to refresh your whole bedroom this year. We're spending a lot of time at home. You deserve a nice bedroom. Super soft percale sheets, all season down duvets. They even have, and I haven't tried this, a cozy, calming, weighted blanket. I hear good things. I might try this. And, of course, the glow lamp, which I love. As always, Casper offers free shipping and free returns with no contact delivery. These are the best mattresses you can get. and I love them. Make 2021 comfortable. Reset your rest. Go to casper.com/twit1. If you use the code TWIT1, you'll get $100 off select mattresses. Some terms and conditions apply. You can see casper.com for more details. That's Casper, CASPER.com/TWIT1, and the offer code TWIT1 for $100 off select mattresses. I have to add it up. I think I've bought 6 or 7 Casper mattresses. Everybody in my family, my sister-in-law, my son, my daughter, everybody sleeps on Caspers. We did mention Bernie everywhere. There is a there was a site that says that was put Bernie anywhere. It merged this picture of Bernie Sanders at the inauguration in his big old mittens with your Google Maps location. You could enter any address. Apparently, it was very popular, and the guy has now shut it down. Probably cost a lot. He says, due to API costs, I can't keep the site going. He created 9.8 million Bernie memes. There he is. Hi, Bernie. How you doing? Bernie Sanders is now selling T-shirts for charity with the Bernie meme on the T-shirt, which I think is great. Let's see. Sad. We'll do a couple of obituaries. You remember the ultimate collection of windsock software, two cows. Do you guys in France or
I do.
UK used it? Yeah. It was a BBS originally, founded in 1993 on a library computer in Flint, Michigan. Eventually became probably the number one download site in the world. But it is now, I'm sad to say, being turned off. Elliot Noss, who is the CEO and good friend, They're giving the archive to the Internet Archives, as it should be, because we don't want to forget this. They've gone on to other things, as you know. They do Hover.com, our sponsor. They have Ting Internet, another sponsor that does phones. So they're doing other things. But I don't know. I'm old enough to remember downloading a lot of stuff from Two Cows.
I remember Two Cows. I mean, Those sites back in the day, I think my fondness for them just stems from the fact that when we were on dial-up modems, you'd spend a lot of time staring at that logo.
Oh, yeah.
And if you were going to stare at a logo, why wouldn't you want to stare at a bunch of cows?
I mean, exactly.
It's just nice.
Exactly.
So, yeah, twocowsdownload.com. I mean, I know that's still around. And SourceForge, but all of those kind of repositories, I've got a big fondness for those dating back to the 90s.
LG is considering getting out of smartphones. I think it must be the wing that really put them down. That was the weird swiveling phone. They actually make some pretty nice phones, but Samsung, Huawei, Xiaomi just dominate, and they just can't compete. So apparently LG's CEO has notified employees that they're considering winding down the smartphone business. Actually, here's a good story. The Raspberry Pi Foundation has launched a new Raspberry Pi $4. It's one of their custom chips. It's a microcontroller. It really isn't a full Raspberry Pi, because it doesn't run an operating system. You write code directly to run on the chip. But for $4, I bet there's a lot of cool things people are going to do with that. So the Raspberry Pi continuing to hit things out of the park. Nate, did you have an Acorn or a BBC Micro?
Of course, I had an Acorn.
Of course you did.
I had an Acorn Archimedes A3000. It was one of the best things that I've ever owned. It's the history of Acorn is well worth dipping into as well, because you've got bits of Acorn that went off into
ARM,
like,
yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing, the legacy of Acorn. Yes, I mean, that's a simpler answer. Yes, I had an Acorn. I loved it. Can you tell? I loved my Acorn.
Every Brit had a BBC Micro or an Acorn. These were inexpensive kind of starter computers. You saw Jason Howell in our promo, kind of hugging his C64 clone. When you grew, when that was your first computer, you were, you know, a kid, and you imprint with that. It's like baby ducks. You never forget your first, right?
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. The first one I had didn't even have a hard drive.
Oh no!
So the only way you could create backups of floppy disks was by filling the pitiful amount of RAM that it had with a bit of data.
Swapping. Oi.
I had an Amstrad CPC
664. Yeah.
It wasn't quite the, 628, whatever, but it did have a disk drive, not a cassette drive, which was the lower model. So I was very proud of that one.
Gentlemen, you want to feel old? Let me ask Louise, what was your first?
Trying to think. I think my first smartphone was...
No. See, there's the problem right there. We're talking about computers.
Well, I feel like I had a smartphone before I had a computer.
See, I feel old. It worked.
I feel like I wasn't, because I was old enough to get a smartphone, but I was still like using, well, to be fair, my mom had AOL for a long time, and I would use like dial-up to do my homework.
Now I feel
better. Yeah, okay. And she had like, you know, a Dell dial-up or something, right. And I remember, right. You know, I would aim chat with my friends on there. But I feel like my first, like, you know, computing experience was really getting a smartphone.
First computer. But see, that's what's happening, right? That's going to be true of my kids, of everybody. Your first computer was a smartphone.
I did. But I will say, I think I was like that weird cutoff generation where, like, you know, I'm the oldest millennial possible, but I'm not Gen Z. I mean, I'm the youngest millennial possible, but I'm not Gen Z. So like, I didn't like, all my homework was on paper, you know what I mean? Oh. Until like college, basically. Horror. You know what I mean? For the most part. But I feel like the kids now, like, they have no, like, are they still teaching handwriting? Like that sort of thing. Like I still had to like learn how to, do stuff in cursive. And right. It was still like, you know, I went home and like the school day ended. I wasn't like texting my friends all night until like at least middle school, I feel like. Oh, and now God. It's totally different.
I really wonder if they teach handwriting. If they do, stop.
Yeah,
I'll tell you now, my mom is a teacher and they definitely still teach handwriting.
Really?
That's very comforting, honestly. I'm like happy to hear that, because I think it's, if I was a professor or a teacher, I wouldn't like computers in my classroom, honestly.
You need handwriting to take notes. No, that's a good point. You don't
There's
want
also
clacking.
No way that they're paying attention. No. Like even if they, you know, like are using a computer to take notes or whatever, and there's no way. Like I think it's much better to have them have a notebook, because they're actually going to pay attention. They're going to be present. You know, anytime I had a computer in class in college, I was totally like texting my friends.
I was the same. Hey, do you know what? Actually, you just reminded me of something I read earlier. Apparently, guess what's having a comeback?
What?
ICQ.
What?
Really?
Apparently, ICQ is having a renaissance at the moment. Who knew?
I
did.
Because everybody fled WhatsApp and Signal actually was down for a while because so many people. Is this part of that? Like people are saying, well, what about ICQ?
I honestly, I don't know what's prompted it. I just remembered reading it this afternoon that it's having something of a renaissance, because it's like people who were, they used it when they were younger, but they're older now, and there's this nostalgia factor going back, things being simple. And it's apparently, yeah.
It actually looks like Telegram or any other modern.
It might be updated and might look really good now.
It does. It does video calls with up to 30 people. You've got stickers. You've got emojis. You can record audio and video and send it. It's really a full service messenger now. How interesting.
I mean,
smart replies. Who runs the network?
What's smart replies? Does it reply for you?
No, but you know how Google does that when you get a message, it suggests.
Right. So it kind of replies for you. I like that.
You reply with one tap. I like that feature. Wait a minute. I'm going to use ICQ. This looks good.
If I'm not misremembering, when I was at Wired, we had an intern who, for a little while, a Russian chap, really nice guy, and he told me that ICQ has remained incredibly popular
in Russia. That explains,
and it never went away.
That explains this on the website, where the showcase of popular channels and groups is in Russian. All about Moscow.
It must be seeing a lot of activity now.
Wow.
Nate, did you work at Wired UK?
I worked at Wired UK for about 6 years until, when did I leave? I think I left CNET in 2009 and I joined Bloomberg in 2015. So, yeah, between 5 and 6 years.
Were you at this, the same time?
Alumni of Wired in the US. Yeah. No, they didn't really talk to each other that much, which is kind of sad.
But. No, we didn't. We weren't cool enough, unfortunately. But I did come over to the San Francisco office a fair bit. I had some beer out of your beer robot.
It's a nice office.
Yeah, I made it over there.
Well, folks,
so did you
go ahead?
Did you hear of Beeper?
Oh, I didn't even mention Beeper, and this kind of puzzles me because it doesn't seem like this solves a problem that hasn't been solved, but it's from the guy who started Pebble, right?
Yeah.
iMessage on Android using a weird hack. Now, I'm already using something called AirMessage. You have to keep a Mac running all the time, running the AirMessage server. It takes the Apple messages, puts them on the server, and then I can use AirMessages on my Android to check my Apple messages. So it, in effect, it's a hack, but it puts Apple messages on Android. They're going to do that. But then they said for people who don't have or don't want to keep their Mac running all the time, they're going to send them old iPhone 4S's.
Jailbroken iPhone. I mean, the goal initially is to have a unified private message app. So the goal isn't just to have
it's like Pigeon or Adium
except they also do iMessage through that ridiculous hack. I don't think anyone is going to want to keep the, but maybe, I don't know, maybe
I keep maybe I keep my iMac running as a server for AirMessages day and night.
I just feel like how many message platforms do most people have? And I also think like some people like to turn some of them off, right? Like some people want to like pause their work notifications on the weekend and they wouldn't want to pause their iMessages. So yeah. I just wonder like how much this is for like a really connected person, right? Or like someone who's, you know, has so much inbound stuff coming to them. I almost think it might be good for like a real estate agent or like, you know, someone who's dealing with a lot of like inbound communications from all over the place, like maybe like a content creator or something like that. But I just don't know if this is going to appeal to most people. I think if you like, you know, you have like 5 or 6 different social media accounts, you have an email address, you're posting stuff on TikTok, on Instagram, like it's definitely really helpful to like look at that all in one place. But it's cool, though.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like the consumer version of something like Twilio or MessageBird, where they kind of have like, yeah, like this unified inbox that you can WhatsApp to it, you can WeChat to it, or you can email it and vice versa. It doesn't matter. I don't like them in principle because I think you're adding another link that security can be compromised because
That's
of.
That's a good point.
But for pure convenience, if you don't care about security or privacy, then go nuts, I suppose.
I feel like the real problem here is a proliferation of messaging platforms.
I agree.
Because everybody uses a different one. I understand Beeper's trying to solve that, but it's not going to solve it. Can we all just decide on one? I don't care what it is. Signal would be fine. Telegram would be fine. ICQ would be fine. Can we just please stop the insanity? By the way, Pigeon's still around. LibPurple still works, and you still can do it with a lot of different things. I don't know. I just want.
Oh, Pigeon. I used to love
Pigeon. Remember
Pigeon? Oh, what was it that began with T, wasn't it? Trillion?
Trillion. Yeah.
Trillion?
Yes.
That was the Windows Pigeon.
Oh, is that the way around? Okay. That was around the time that I transitioned from primarily being PC to primarily being Mac.
Yeah.
Barry, do you remember?
Adium was the Mac Pigeon.
Adium. That's the what I was trying to think of, actually. Yeah.
Finally, remember the, maybe you don't, the big TikTok fad of last week? Sea shanties? Remember them? These guys singing the old sea songs. This is the Wellerman song. Well, this guy who was a mailman and became huge quit his job and got a record contract.
Why can't any of these people use a proper microphone for crying out loud?
Wait a minute. I got to play this for you. This is from the Today Show. I gotta get my audio switched over so you can hear this. It's a TikTok world. We just live in it. Everybody's doing the sea shanty deal. Ladies
and gentlemen,
I'm
just waiting for the Gregorian throat chanting.
No,
record
what is it? The Tuvan throat singing. I know. Yeah, that'll be a record.
It's great. I've heard that done live in a cave in the Peak District in Derbyshire, and trust me, that is an experience. you don't want to spend too long inside. It can
like rattle your bones.
Drugs without the drugs.
That's Nate Langston. He is the consumer tech reporter for Bloomberg in the UK. He's also the host of the UK Tech Show at uktechshow.com. And I'm going to send you to bed. Anything you want to plug?
No, you've plugged my favorite thing, my podcast, UK Tech Show. We do it every week. It's a lot of fun. It's Tom Merritt and I, good friends. And the good thing about the show is that you can listen to both without any overlap. So Tom covers all the stuff you really need to know, and I tend to cover all the stuff that's just really fun to know. So hopefully you can check it out, uktechshow.com.
Nice. Nice.
Thanks for having me.
Does everybody do a podcast with Tom Merritt? I think it's the case.
Oh, I don't do it with Tom.
Oh, you don't do
Tom
it with Tom?
Tom is on it every week. He does a promo on my show. I do a promo on his show every week.
You share. It's a,
yeah, we
it's
do
a podcast
do each other's
sharing
shows,
relationship. Yes.
I often do it with my brother. He's an editor at CNET.
Oh, nice.
We did this week.
Oh, nice.
For example.
Did he also have an acorn?
Well, we lived together, so we had the same
shared
acorn,
it.
But well, our parents would try and have us share it, but I was a pretty conniving little older brother, so you know, I'd steal his stuff and then sell them back to him, things like that.
Mighty oaks from little acorns grow. Thank you for being here,
Nate.
Thank you, Louise Matsakis, and I love your new publication. I'm very excited about this Rest of World. Three words, but the website is restofworld.org. Is that free?
Yes, it's completely free. There are no ads. We don't track you. And also, the website is really light, and we built it that way on purpose because we want to serve the audiences and the places that we cover, too. So it's a really nice reader experience. Super light, no tracking. We're a nonprofit. If you want to learn about sort of the tech world that you won't hear anywhere else,
I think this is so great. Like the Chinese grocery delivery industry.
Yeah, if you have tips about crazy trends happening, please let me know.
Yeah, it's really
any other.
Do you have funding? How is it supported?
Yeah, so we do have funding. It's a nonprofit. We are supported fully by our founder. Her name is Sophie Schmidt. She's great. She's a former tech executive. She knows a lot about the industry. She's worked abroad all over the place. So yeah, we're a nonprofit. We don't take money from anyone else.
Good for her.
No ads or anything like that.
She's given
so
back.
Really great.
That is awesome. That
yeah.
is awesome. Well, I'm just thrilled to learn about it. Restofworld.org. And I'm so glad to have you on, Louise. What's your
Thanks
podcast?
What,
do you do a show with Tom Merritt?
This
Surely.
Is my podcast.
This is
podcast.
It. This is your podcast.
Here you guys,
right here.
Yeah.
I'll get Tom Merritt on next time. Then you two can have a show with Tom Merritt. and of course, not Patrick. Patrick Beja, always welcome on this show. He does so many shows. They're all at notpatrick.com. And he's not Patrick on the Twitter. Great to see you. Congratulations on that new
Thanks.
Show, Work in Sanity.
Yes, also with Tom Merritt.
Awesome.
So work
Tom's ears
got
to be really red right now. They're going to be hot.
Only good things.
Only good things.
And also, if you speak French or want to speak French, you could check out Le Rendez-vous Tech because you get the English version with This Week in Tech. And then you already know half the things we're going to be talking about. So if you want to learn French or practice French, you listen to the French version and you have my sultry voice, and we talk about stuff you already know, so it's easier to understand.
And in France, beeper is beepé. right?
Eggs. Wow. That was impressive.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Nate. Really great having you. It's always nice when we have such a smart panel. Lots to talk about. I hope you enjoyed our show today. We do This Week in Tech Sunday afternoons, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern Time, 22:30 UTC. And a reason I give you the time we record is you can watch us live. We have a live stream at all hours of the day or night at twit.tv/live. It's live audio or video. Watch whatever you want. If you're watching live, the chat room also goes 24/7 at irc.twit.tv. Lovely people in there. So I encourage you to check that out, irc.twit.tv. If you want to download the shows and listen at your leisure, of course you can do that. All of our shows are available at twit.tv. We also have a full-bore YouTube channel for every single show, including This Week in Tech. You can subscribe there. My favorite thing would be if you would get a podcast client, doesn't matter which, and subscribe in that, because that way you get it automatically. You don't have to think about it. And if you're ever in the mood for another twit, you can just fire up your podcast client, and there it'll be waiting for you. It's that time again. Our annual survey is going strong. We don't want to miss your feedback. So please help us out. Go to twit.tv/survey21 to take the survey. It closes next month, but it helps us understand our audience, helps us make your podcasts better suited to you. It also helps us sell advertising. We don't spy on you. We don't track you. Once a year, we ask you a few questions. Completely optional. It'll only take a few minutes, but it sure would help if you go to twit.tv/survey21. And thanks in advance. We have a couple of ways you can interact with us. We have a wonderful forums at www.twit.community. Those are discourse forums, and they're really good. And many of our hosts hang out there. It's a great way to comment on any show. Every show has an entry there, so you can comment there. We also, as I mentioned, have a Mastodon instance at twit.social, and you're welcome to join us there if you're not already on Mastodon. The way Mastodon works, it's like a federated Twitter. So you join an instance, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them. In fact, if you go to joinmastodon.org, I think, you can pick an instance that you like, but one of them is twit.social. You could follow the folks locally on that instance or follow anybody on any other instance because it's federated. And so I think it's a nice antidote to Twitter. Not quite so busy, but a lot of fun. You're welcome to join us there. No charge, of course, for that. That's it for this edition of This Week in Tech. Thank you, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next weekend. Another twit.
It's amazing.